Good afternoon. I'd like to bring into session the House Interim Committee on General Government Consumer Protection for this interim meeting, May 21st. And committee and members of the public, we're having an informational meeting today on the overview of the construction and landscaping worlds and the regulation around that and requirements of those agencies and how they may or may not overlap. And after that, around 3:30, we will be going into foreclosure, a discussion of foreclosure mediation program and homeowner assistance. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and open the informational meeting and bring up Craig Smith from the Construction Contractors Board, Shelley Sneed from Landscape Contractors Board, and Mark Long.
I'm not going to be totally alone.
Good.
Doing good. I went to a...
Good afternoon, and as you know, we've decided to have this informational meeting. There's been a lot of different issues around construction contractor licensing, educational requirements, and you know who has authority over what and who can do what, and as well as some of the penalties and violations associated with some of that has also come up in discussions. So we wanted to just get an overview from the agency's perspective on administering their portion of this topic. So I don't know who would like to go first. I know that I saw you guys flipping coins in the back. So let's see the outcome of that coin toss.
Representative Holvey and co-chair Wisnett, members of the committee, Craig Smith is my name, and I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. We did draw lots, and I did get the small straw. So I'm privileged to be here before you this morning and being able to go first. Thank you for the opportunity to address you and provide you with some information about the regulation in Oregon for construction contractors. I'm surrounded by my friends with building codes and landscape. They're going to provide some information. I understand after I give you a quick overview on CCB, I provided some written material, and it's somewhat voluminous because I wasn't sure where you might hit. But in short, I'm going to give you a quick overview of the CCB, how it works, talk a little bit about our discipline and enforcement, talk about the continuing education which we have instituted over the course of the last couple of years, and to be honest with you, is difficult for us, it's difficult for some of our stakeholders. And also talking about the property manager exemption in the Construction Contractors Board that Representative Holvey asked me to highlight, as well as talk about the overlap in regulation amongst the three of us. With that, the written materials is a fairly brief outline that I plan on going over, and then some supportive materials that I may point to as we go along. So looking at page 2, you know the Construction Contractors Board is your agency that licenses all construction contractors in Oregon, save for the landscape industry. We regulate construction contractors, we promote a competitive business environment, and some of you may not know what we do in that competitive business environment. Increasingly, over the last 20 years, what the legislature and Oregonians have asked of the Construction Contractors Board is to take a look at items that involve consumer protection, but also other areas. For the first time, about 15 years ago, we were tasked with commercial contractor regulation. And a few years ago, we divided the way we regulate contractors in Oregon between residential and commercial contractors. So a significant portion of what we do involves consumers, but not all of it. And perhaps we'll talk about some of that as we go along. We have really four major programs: education of consumers as well as contractors, pre-education before licensure as well as continuing education, licensing itself, which in our regulatory environment is somewhat difficult. It's pretty complicated. Enforcement and contractor discipline, which is designed to try to educate contractors on what they need to do to comply with the many regulations in the industry, but also when that doesn't work, guide them towards compliance. And then what some of you perhaps have experienced, which is our what amounts to a mediation or dispute resolution service that in the past has been remarkably successful in Oregon in resolving disputes between consumers and contractors, and has changed since last legislative session. So the licensing, how is that done? We divide contractors into commercial and residential. You know about that. There are many different subcategories, probably most of them you don't want to go into. Perhaps one of the little-known classifications that every contractor is divided into is what's known as the class of independent contractor. It's an interesting thing, because that's the one that intersects with worker classification. And this has been a big deal over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. You have heard of the Interagency Compliance Network, originally put together over at Department of Revenue, and has, I think, been a champion of one of the co-chairs. That is the law with construction contractors that intersect with that independent contractor versus worker definition. And so that's very important. We call it exempt and non-exempt. And every contractor is divided into one or the other. For the most part, your contractor's board not only identifies the contractor, identifies the people who work in that business entity, but then also provides for bonding, insurance, tests for business competency, and also on the commercial side, verifies that a person has certain experience requirements to be in that business. We have some individual licenses. We don't just license businesses. We also license a small amount of lead-based paint abatement individuals, lead-based paint supervisors, and other folks that are involved in the lead industry. Home inspectors are with the contractors board. And what a small industry that in the past hasn't been regulated until about 4 years ago, Oregon locksmiths. So again, the purpose of licensure is to try to encourage compliance. The field investigations unit is a unit that goes out, and we've got, thanks to you, about 10 folks on any given day, they're out in the field looking at job sites, responding to complaints from licensed contractors, making sure that folks are properly licensed. And from time to time, we will be on a job site and we'll see some plumbing and electrical contractors. We'll ask for those license checks. We work with Mr. Long's crew. When we find someone who isn't properly licensed in those fields, we'll write a report. We'll share that report with Building Codes Agency. And we do that once in a while with landscape as well, as they do with us. Some folks are unfamiliar with the due process in administrative law that is involved with giving any kind of a discipline to a contractor. The lawyers among you will be familiar with the difference between civil and administrative law. Of course, that's what we practice. There's quite a bit of process for a citizen who is alleged to have violated a regulation with our licensing law. It includes a notice of intent, opportunity for hearing, and contested case hearings. And then the appeals, and I wanted to highlight the appeals, which is on page 3 at the bottom, because perhaps one of the most important parts of the way this is set up in Oregon, and is similar in many other states, is the ability of a person who's alleged to have been violated a law to get past the bureaucrat and get to the human beings that are the policymakers. And that happens, I think, in all three agencies to one degree or another. Certainly happens at the Construction Contractors Board. So if they're found to have been violated the law, the administrative law judge has agreed with the staff, that person can come before the board and argue their case, and they often do. Civil penalties, the amount of civil penalty is a very difficult part of our policymaking. It has evolved over the years. I think it's one of the tough things that I think all three agencies deal with is to want to make sure that the penalty is not too high but not too low. And you want to be able to have flexibility in there so you're able to deal with special circumstances. At the same time, you don't want to be arbitrary. So this is a difficult task, but of course the agencies deal with this every day. I wanted to draw your attention to the Construction Contractors Board civil penalties, which are on Appendix C. Which I will find later and share with you. because I'm not pulling it out. I guess the most important
page 34.
You got it, 34?
Yeah.
So these rules have been developed since 1972. They're somewhat voluminous here, but each one of these rules affects a specific violation that the board enforces. And as I say, these are guidelines. That's what staff uses and what the administrative law uses, but that can be changed to some degree by the board when exceptions are filed.
On that point, Craig, a quick question while you're moving to another topic. Does the administrative law judge have the ability to adjust the fine or the penalty?
So, Chair Holby, the question, of course, is does the judge have authority? In some cases, they do. It depends on how the agency has written its rules. And I think that in many instances, the agency is hesitant to allow the judge to provide to have that kind of leeway. I mean, the experience in criminal law, for those of us who have been involved in that over the last 20 or 30 years, you know the yin and the yang of that. And that is, you can certainly make sense to give the judge leeway unless the judge isn't as strong as you think they should be. And so that's the difficulty. And I think this is a policy issue. What some would say is the judge is the person who ought to have that authority. What others would say is we want that board or commission to have the authority because they're the experts in the field. Civil penalties are collected, of course. They don't do any good if they're not collected. In the construction industry, sometimes it's real difficult because we're dealing with folks in some cases that don't even have an address. And are offering to do, in some cases, hurting consumers. So we do a diligent job of trying to collect those civil penalties. We'll collect about $1 million this year in civil penalties. You should know that those penalties go to the general fund for the most part. We're happy about that. We think that's the way it ought to be. We don't think that the agency should run its services off of the penalties. But that's a policy choice. Some folks see it otherwise. Some folks would like those penalties to be used for keeping the fees down, and you can certainly argue that point one way or the other.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, would you repeat what you just said, that the fines you get are not used by your agency, so it's not like you're a bounty hunter out there looking for...
Co-chairs, and Representative Wisnett and committee, the Construction Contractors Board does not collect, does not keep the majority of the civil penalties. It keeps 20% so to pay for the cost of collecting, but 80% of that money goes to the general fund. I like it that way. Our board likes it that way. That's the way we like to keep it.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, sure.
Mr. Smith, what percentage of other boards, agencies that have these, is most of that goes back into them, right? You're different, and are you an exception to that?
Co-Chair Wisnett and Co-Chair Holby and committee members, I haven't done a study on that, so I can tell you that some folks keep the majority of their fines, other folks don't. I think there's some, like I say, I know stakeholders, some stakeholders at the Construction Contractors Board would like us to keep all of that money and therefore keep the fees down lower. There's some policy issues on that, and my experience has been that I would much prefer that the agency give that money to some other worthy cause. The money should not be designed, in my estimation, to run the agency. I'd rather have that in our fees.
Thank you.
You know, about 15, 20 years ago, we started talking about continuing education. And continuing education is a concept, I think, in adult education and regulation, wherein after a person has passed a test, that if they're regulated, they should continue to learn. and they should take some kind of classes to keep up with their industry. And it's quite common in plumbing and electrical and everything down to hairdressing and tattoo artists and the whole nine yards. Continuing education is a common accepted way for a regulatory body to keep up. And then for regulators to have a requirement in order to get renewed, you have to have some kind of continuing education. Lawyers, you know, are used to it. It's the CLEs. In some cases, they're loved. In some cases, they're not. I can tell you that the construction industry, 15 years ago, the board was of the opinion, I can recall one board member saying, not over my dead body. Okay? And the reason they said that is because it is very difficult dealing with, in some industries, to try to get buy-in on the part of the folks that have been going on for years and years and years to some form of mandatory continuing education process. And so it was until 2006. When we had the, I think in this group, maybe not these individuals, but certainly this committee well knows, and Mr. Long well knows, or as we work through the difficult times in 2004 and 5 when we had the insurance rates go through the roof and a lot of complaints in the media about quality of construction work. And we brought together this task force on construction claims that at Building Codes Agency properly shepherded through for a year studying the problem. And what we found was that, of course, the insurance rates rose because there were a lot of construction claims. There were a lot of construction claims because the work wasn't being done right. So they analyzed, well, what do we need to do to try to get the work done right? And there were some, I think there were 20, 25 recommendations by this panel. Among those recommendations were many things that became bills in front of the folks before you, and maybe some of you, Mr. and Representative Holby. One of the bills had a requirement for the Construction Contractors Board to come up with a continuing education plan sometime during the next 4 years. That was passed in 2007, and that's what we began working on. Coincidentally, at the same time, the construction industry, the commercial construction industry, offered a bill to separate it from the residential contractors. That bill, 3242, also had a continuing education component. It was interesting, and it was easier for the Construction Contractors Board because it was prescriptive. It said precisely what kind of continuing education would be allowed and how many hours each of the different types of businesses had to take. That was a little easier for the Construction Contractors Board because it was settled. And we instituted that quickly, and that has had some pushback, but not a tremendous amount. It also is almost all electives. There are no prescribed courses. In some cases, it may be as many as 80 hours for 2 years, but the type of education is contained in the statute, and it specifically requires that the Construction Contractors Board not manage that process in terms of the classes that are offered. The same wasn't true on the residential side. And there were many in the residential side that suggested that there need to be a little more structure for residential. And there also were some key components that the task force showed need to be addressed. Among those were a failure on the part of some contractors not to understand the regulations that they needed to follow. The licensing laws, the notice laws, and some of the other things that are involved in the rules that pertain to their business. Also, some contractors didn't understand building codes. It seems pretty elementary, but it became clear that they weren't clear on the building codes. And lastly, the biggest problem that drove insurance claims up was water intrusion. And water intrusion, whether it's coming because of improper grading or improper roofing, or siding or windows, or damage to any one of those portions. Those things drove water into the house and within a period of time caused problems that drove up the cost of construction claims. So the agency decided that it would use an approach wherein we'd have a limited amount of hours in this case 16, was pulled out of the air. 8 hours would be prescriptive. It would ask folks to go to 3 hours of studying the regulations, 3 hours of studying the whole concept of building exterior shell training, and why it doesn't matter if you're the roofer or the weather stripper, you've got a part to play in keeping that structure water sound. You may not be building it, but you need to understand that you could damage it. And so the board rationed that what we should do is come up with, have everybody take that building exterior shell training. And it seemed like a good idea until we started getting a lot of pushback from folks. And some of those pushbacks are reasonable. And in 2011, there was a bill in front of you, there's a Senate bill, that made it clear that the legislature wanted some exemptions to codes and building exterior shell. That was Senate Bill 155. And so the board, working with the industry, came up with some exceptions. Those exceptions were that if folks were already taking a lot of continuing education, particularly continuing education wherein they argued that they're already studying the outside structure, such was the case with plumbers and electricians, you wouldn't have to take the codes and the best training from CCB. After all, you already are taking hours and hours of codes training if you're a plumbing and electrical contractor. And then the same held true for the engineers and the architects, so that if they had those professional licenses, they could substitute something else rather than the CCB prescriptive training, and they would not have to take those classes. And then a third exemption was for anybody who absolutely doesn't touch the structure whatsoever. We had some folks that installed iron railing. We had some folks that did some other work on the outside of the structure that didn't touch it at all, never went inside, doesn't have anything to do with it, and if they could certify that they didn't touch the structure, they wouldn't have to take those two classes. Instead, they'd substitute something else that, whatever they wanted to, that made sense to their business. So those were the prescriptive 8 hours that people had to take and how the exceptions worked. And then lastly, there are 8 hours of electives. People can take whatever they want from an elective standpoint. The agency didn't have the resources to sift through all the possible electives, so all we asked was something very similar to the commercial, which is you tell us what you took, you swear that it was legitimate. Perhaps we'll look at this, tightening this down sometime later, but if you take anything, whether it's computer science, some folks suggested they had to have heavy equipment training. Other folks suggested they needed even language training because they're working in a certain community. Anything that helped their business was satisfactory for this elective process. So that's what we've been doing for the last 3 years with continuing education. We began with residential October of 2011. We're into it now about 11 months, and my phone rings about every day from stakeholders and legislators who aren't as delighted with this product as we are, and we're not totally satisfied ourselves. It's very difficult. We're talking about individuals who have had a lifetime of nobody telling them what to do and when to do it when it comes to training. And we're trying to, we think, do the right thing. I think what the legislature asked us to do, which was to provide, start pushing people towards this idea of lifetime learning and provide flexibility at the same time, make sure that individuals have the kind of knowledge they have to have in order not to have leaky buildings. Continuing education. That perhaps is one of the main reasons we're here today. And I wanted to stop here and take a breath. And I know you've got other folks you want to talk to here, but if there are some questions I can answer on this topic, I'd like to take them now.
Senator Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a good question constructed here, so I'll define a problem and see if you can respond to it. I have a good friend who's a window installer, and they sell and install windows. Said that it's lately, it's been a huge problem with contractors from Vancouver coming across the river, and they have a much different tax structure over there, and he's not able to compete financially on some of those jobs. Have you been hearing that from other members, and what, if anything, has the CCB done to try to address this issue?
Representative Sheehan and co-chairs, Representative Sheehan, if I understand the question, it is, what are you doing to stop illegal trafficking across the border?
No, I don't think it's illegal. It's because I think they are licensed in Oregon, but they set up shop in Washington specifically because the tax structure is more is better for them in Washington.
Well, and so thank you for that. I think that the direct answer to your question is that is a concern I haven't had expressed to me. I would want to work with individuals like that to try to make Oregon a better tax structure. That's a key element. There's no question about how that pushes people to one location or another. I can tell you that my friends in California are suffering as a result of that, and we need to be wiser in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, I have four questions, and I appreciate you're always responsive to this committee and to the members of this committee and your work, and I appreciate that very much. As you said, we've all got constituents that always want to come to you, and I've got some wanting more training, some wanting less. I guess we talked about, and I guess this is a statement, not a question, I'm not prepared to force the issue with legislation or anything like that. That's all the power we have, even though constituents sometimes believe we can change the world. I'll respect your board's decision. I wish that they'd been more flexible in the education, continuing education requirement of the gentleman in the paper, the 70-year-old or whatever that was featured there about he. I was hoping that the board would have been acceptable, as we discussed, to maybe having an interview with the gentleman and seeing if they could, based upon that interview, give him credit for his experience. Second question is, what's the board doing? I think it's an ongoing problem. Contractors going bankrupt, not doing good work, coming back in the state with a new name or a new position. Could you talk about the board's work in that? Second is, I think home inspectors are real important. Are they all required to be licensed in the state of Oregon, and do they have more extensive training? I would think that these people would need more extensive training to be quality home inspectors. The third thing is that your board has looked at the governor's executive order 1205 and how you're going to support that, or what the financial impact of your board would be to implement that executive order. Thank you.
Okay. So, Co-Chair Wisnett and members of the committee, you have me at a disadvantage on executive order 1205, and so it's not.
Don't feel bad, me too.
You don't know anything about the.
I don't know it by number. And I don't recall something coming in.
The Oregon Green Chemistry Innovation Initiative.
I'm sorry, sir. I'll get some information to you. I can't say that one is right on the tip of my tongue.
That's fine. Thank you. Thank you.
And then, so taking them in reverse order, home inspectors. So home inspectors are those individuals that you hire to take a look at a house you're thinking about buying, right? So what they do is they come in and look at the existing structure, they'll write a report, and the question is, well, surely they have to have more training, and the answer is correct. That is absolutely correct. In Oregon, in order to do that trade, you must be certified as a home inspector, and that's not the same in every state. Every state has different laws, of course, but Oregon is a little bit more restrictive than I would say 80% of the states in the United States with regard to home inspectors. That's not to say you couldn't do more, but they do have to pass a special test. Every individual who does that work has to pass that test, and then they can only offer their services if they own themselves or work for a construction contractor, often a general contractor.
Thank you. And last one was going after contractors when they come back in the state.
So that question, thank you, that question has to do with contractors. There are really two parts to it. You and your predecessors have been very, I think, very smart in the way you set up the Construction Contractors Board. You've set it up so you're licensing a business, and you've set it up so that we look at every human being that's associated with that business. So we're really licensing whatever that partnership is. And it could be an LLC, or it could be a corporation, or it could be a simple partnership or an individual. But we're looking at every human being, and we're asking that human being what their record is. If that person has construction debt in this state or any other state, or a criminal history of one kind or another, or a past history in another business, either in this state or in a different one, we're able to precise that out and hold that business accountable for that human being's behavior. Now the problem, and this is where your question began, was with the bankruptcy laws. And many of you know that the bankruptcy laws are such that if that construction debt has been discharged in bankruptcy, it does restrain the regulator. And maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a tough thing. From my perspective, it's a tough thing. And others, it gives people a second chance. But we identify, we ask for proof if debts have been discharged in bankruptcy. We follow up on that. If they have been discharged in bankruptcy, that person gets to start again.
Thank you very much.
And just to follow up with that question from Representative Wisnett, it's a good one. As well, in not just talking about bankruptcy, but what, and I think you sort of alluded to this, that you're able to hold the individual accountable, but what if, someone breaks some other type of law or regulatory laws within the construction world, and then they dissolve their corporation and open up a new corporation where their license has been taken away? Can they go back out and get another license, or have their wife get another license, or, and stay in business even though you've taken regulatory action to take their license away?
Right. So, Co-Chair Holvey and members of the committee, a couple of questions there. First of all, they can't just dump the corporation and start over again, because we look at that corporation as having a debt, but every corporate officer is responsible for that debt. So if they try to dump that and start a brand new one and it hasn't been discharged in bankruptcy, that prevents them from getting a license with the Construction Contractors Board. The second issue has to do with, I think I heard you say, what about problems with other agencies? So if someone has and we have this from time to time, a history of not pulling permits or doing electrical work, and they have run up a bill with building codes of unpaid civil penalties, and they're not paying those. They don't have a plan mm-hmm. where they're paying those off. We'll not license them as a construction contractor. And if they are licensed, we'll look at suspending their license until they start working with the other agency, such as the case with Landscape Board and others as well. So we look at civil penalties. Workers' comp is the same way. Somebody doesn't pay the workers' comp debt, they're not going to be able to stay in business with they're not going to be able to keep their CCB license. Now, the last one is more problematic. And that's the one where, I hate to say it's gender specific, but it often is. And that's where a gentleman will do a poor job, they'll run a business into the ground, they'll establish a bunch of debt, and quite often then they'll get a lady, usually it isn't another guy, it's usually a lady. The saddest cases are where it's their mother. And we've had cases where young men have run things into the ground. They can't get a license on their own. They'll get their mother to take out the bond, and their mother is the licensee. And mom looks like they're really doing it, but they're not. He's doing it, and he'll do that one. He'll run that one in the ground, and then the mother is held for those debts. And in some cases, they're ending up having to pay that bond company what the bond company pays out. And it happens with girlfriends and wives and grandmothers. But it usually, the answer to the question is, just because the gentleman is has messed up their life, and they can't get a license themselves. Can we somehow prevent the wife from getting a license? The answer is no, we're not successful in that usually.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
Just a quick follow-up, if you will, and maybe this may be the spot where you would have the answer, maybe not. So in that scenario where somebody were to have their mother open the company, let's say their wife, their spouse, all of a sudden now they're the contractor under the license, does that then qualify them for some of the prioritizations of, minority, when you get minority preference? Is that another thing that's going on too, where some of the men in the business are actually putting the names of perhaps a spouse or mother on the contract so that they could get those jobs? I've had some contractors, and the reason I ask, Mr. Chair, is I've had a few contractor friends of mine that are accusing the state of doing that, and I'm just curious, is that at all possible, and if so, is that through your agency as well?
Okay. So, co-chairs and Representative Matthews, the question is, do sometimes folks list their wives or girlfriends on the business in order to get preferential treatment on bidding? I can't tell you I've known anybody who's done that. I certainly have heard stories of such. I would be naive if I told you that never happened. But they certainly don't do it through this agency, through CCB.
Okay, thank you.
So, the next item on here was had to do with the exclusion from CCB for property managers. And this is where our friends at Real Estate, you may choose to talk to them, but I know I talked a little bit with Representative Holvey about this. I can tell you that we do have an exclusion for folks that are property licensed through the real estate agency and have a property management business. So if they are doing that and they're operating within the scope of their license, they don't need to be licensed with the Construction Contractors Board. That law goes back quite some period of time. I've got some history on that. Happy to go through that rather than tie up your time with it. I'll save that until you want to talk about it. But that is the law in Oregon. Property managers don't have to be licensed with the Construction Contractors Board when they're doing the repairs authorized under that license.
So before you leave that particular topic and we move on, and I don't want to beleaguer it too much, but in terms of that particular exemption, I believe the lending institutions are also exempt from having to get construction contractor licenses. And the reason I asked about this is because I've had a couple of constituent issues in actually around foreclosures where the lending institution goes to a realtor and they do all this fix-it work without permits or without licenses, and they're exempt from the licenses and they don't have to have one. And in so fixing those things up, then they sell the property to the consumer and there is no protection for the consumer for the work that's been done, because it's normally the properties are sold as is. And so there's never any question about whether or not anybody's bonded, insured, or licensed in that whole discussion. I'm not saying it probably happens a lot. I think most realtors and lending institutions hire licensed contractors to do their work. But frankly, the law doesn't require that. It actually gives them quite a large exemption to perform construction contracting work without licenses. And when I originally looked at that, that's why I wanted to call the real estate agency up to see what they could do, but actually the law that allows them to do that's under the CCB law. And I was just kind of curious, because I believe that law also extends to the employees of that real estate licensee or the employee of the lending institution as well. And so I'm just, I guess I was curious why those exemptions, if you knew, you said it was quite some time ago, why those exemptions were put in. because it seems like it's sort of contrary to licensing contractors and providing, you know, some sort of consumer protection that you're covered, I guess, with the type of work that's being done, and it's being done by a professional.
So, Co-Chair Holvey and members of the committee, on page 44 and 45, we've got some legislative history on this particular exemption. It's a little interesting because as we went back and took a look at this, some of you may remember the committee staff that you've had over the last 10 years, Jim Stembridge. Mm-hmm. And Jim testified in 1991 on this issue as the deputy of the Construction Contractors Board. And so some of his testimony is here. I think that what you'll find is this is a balancing of trying to weigh industry's request to reduce regulation, in this case, the need to have a CCB license, with the amount of damage that might be caused. And so proponents of this law probably argued that here's a situation where you have a professional realtor who understands what ought to be done and what not ought to be done, and they should be able to do minor repairs as long as you're not doing plumbing and electrical work, and that you don't need the burden of the CCB license. And I would guess, although I haven't gone back and taken a look at the lending institution exemption, you'd have a similar argument. The history is on page 45 in the middle of the page.
So I'm just going to follow up with that. So when a licensed construction contractor does work on a property and it's sold to a buyer, is there any sort of claim possible against that construction contractor after the property's been sold for work that they've done?
All right. And so, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee, the question is if a construction contractor does work, is it possible for a buyer within, if the work has been done with last year? Absolutely. You'd be able to have a complaint with the Construction Contractors Board. There's some bond there. We don't have the same hearings process as we used to, but the bond's there.
And you probably wouldn't be able to answer my question as to whether or not a real estate licensee or a lending institution would have a similar responsibility to the buyer.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, that would probably be best answered by Mr. Owens.
Okay. Thank you.
So if you're ready, I'll conclude by talking a little bit about the overlap between the agencies. You know, the Construction Contractors Board does license construction contractors, of course, and all plumbing and electrical contractors are licensed with the CCB. We provide a variety of services to those folks, including the bond insurance and the things that we've talked a little bit about. The Landscape Contractors Board is a little different. Those folks do not need to be licensed with the CCB. That's a carve-out, and it's special. It really is special in Oregon. I think the community of landscape professionals will talk a little bit about their regulatory scheme, but suffice it to say, I've had a chance to take a look at what some other states do. Oregon is special, I think, and that I don't know all the states that do it like this, but I can tell you that they take it very seriously here in Oregon. Landscape contractors are highly tested, and you may hear a little bit about that later, and they have a separate regulatory scheme that's very much parallel with construction contractors. They have the same kind of dispute resolution, some of the bonding and other things. So they kind of parallel what the CCB does, but focus on the landscaping trade. There are some construction type activities like fencing and so forth that are mutual between the two regulatory agencies. If you want to, we can talk more in depth about that. But for the most part, landscapers handle plants. Construction contractors are all about buildings. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Smith.
So forgive this question. It is far-ranging and partly motivated to prod thinking that I might not have a chance or I won't have a chance to prod some months from now. Our entire regulatory background structure was largely built, prior to you know, information technology. And it was really, really important, and remains really, really important, to make sure that buyers actually have an ability to beware. And on matters that are more complex than any particular home buyer might be able to evaluate, that they could have some confidence. Actually helps commerce. You're more confident in buying a product. I'm more willing to buy aspirin in this country than I visit another country, because, you know, as I know that some trialer is going to sue their ass if they sue themselves, some other person, not body part. If they don't, you know, if the screw top isn't done right. So thanks. So I guess my question is, have we thought about, within your ambit, how we might rethink our regulatory structure based on availability of greater information? Maybe it's not taking anything away. Maybe it's adding to. Maybe it's providing little scores for people who are consumers, either very informed consumers or more sort of typical consumers, to use smartphones and Yelp sites and whatever else. Talk to us about what's happening how you're thinking about that. Because I imagine, anyway, and that'll certainly have probably different comfort levels with some of your old timers and some of your new timers. But yeah, talk to me a little about that.
That's a great question, co-chairs, Representative Smith, and committee members. It goes to, you know, what does tomorrow bring, and how can we protect consumers at less cost using technology? I think it's fair to say that we've got some really smart folks over the contractors board. They're IT people that enjoy thinking outside the box, we have a website. Everybody's got a website, and everybody's got a great website. But we've got some folks that are thinking about things like short message stuff, iPhones. One of the things we did on training was that we developed the training. We made sure it was online, and then we developed it so that those folks that watched that training would be able to look and use their smartphone to look at that training when it was over again. And we think that's an advantage with complex regulations these days. It doesn't cost them a dime. They take it once, and they can watch it as many times as they want. They can be at a person's home taking a look at what they have to have in the contract. On the consumer side, we don't have quite as much going on. We're pushing this technology more towards consumers, but we've reached out to other professionals that help regulate this industry, people like the insurance agents and others that we partner with, try to reduce the cost involved in when they have to send bonds and insurance information to us. So I think, obviously, technology is huge. There's no question about it. It's changed the way we live, and it's going to change, I think, the way we offer technology. I've got a pretty good relationship with some of my friends in other states. We haven't gone as far, I think, in thinking outside of the box as you're suggesting, but I think that we will. Most of the states today are somewhat constrained because of resources.
Sure.
And so I look forward to the day that I can come to you and not talk about continuing education and the difficulty about that, but rather about some opportunities we have with the IT solutions to try to make life a little easier for our licensees, but for our consumers as well.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'd like to, we could probably ask another half hour questions of you, but we probably should hear from the other two agencies at this point. So who drew the middle straw?
I was the middle straw. Representatives, committee members, thank you for having us here today. I'd like to introduce Larry Thomas, our board chair. Larry's one of our licensees, so he's here as the word on the street. So if you have questions, and he'll present one of the slides today. So we prepared a PowerPoint hoping to help you save paper and resources. So you heard from the CCB, and you heard Craig say that we were carved out of the CCB. So there's a lot of parallels between our agency and how we operate and the CCB. What I want to set the framework for is that we're a five-person fee-based agency. So there's a dramatic difference in resources. So you'll also see that we have a simpler licensing scheme as well. So today we're going to talk a little bit about our agency, just, you know, some basic information. We're going to go over the statutes and some definitions. We're going to talk about licensing. We're going to talk about our agency's relationships with the two other agencies that are here today. We're also going to talk about continuing education, and I can say ditto to some of what you heard from Craig. I think our licensees are a little concerned, but we'll tell you how the program works and how the board has made some changes recently. We'll talk about our enforcement program. I know that's an area of interest. And then we'll start, we'll end with what doesn't require a license, because that's some of what I know you hear is, do I need some, you know, can my neighbor kid mow my lawn? So we'll go over that at the end. But ask questions as we go through, please. So just to set the stage, we want to make it clear that even though we're small, we are a state agency, and we do follow the formal rulemaking process. So sometimes you'll hear from your constituents that, as you do for other agencies, that they don't have a voice in the rulemaking process, and that's not the case. So I've just outlined how they can participate. The board recently made several rule changes, including continuing ed. We were looking at a new license that would have, we thought, been a gateway for folks who are doing maintenance work into licensing with us. During that process, we were really excited to get a lot of licensee and unlicensed feedback. So I think that folks are learning how to interface with us, and where there's a will, there's a way with the agency. So 671.520 defines a landscape construction professional, and you'll see that there's a list of activities that a licensed individual can do. In Oregon, individuals cannot operate without a business license, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. So landscaping work includes planning or installing a variety of things that you can read. It includes preparing property where things are going to be planted. It includes constructing or repairing ornamental water features, drainage systems, or irrigation systems. And we'll talk more about irrigation systems in a little bit. It's a unique feature of our agency. Maintaining irrigation systems with the use of compressed air. For some of us in the Valley, we don't know a lot about that, but for those of you in Central Oregon, that's been a major issue with our licensees because it affects the longevity of the system. And then the dual jurisdiction areas that we'll talk about with the CCB, planning or installing fences, decks, arbors, patios, landscape edging, driveways, walkways, or retaining walls. So I think the original vision was that people build relationships with businesses, and that's the goal as business owners, and they want to have a one-stop shop for their outdoor areas. And so these are the things that they can do. A landscape contracting business is a business that for compensation or with the intent to be compensated, arranges, submits a bids, or otherwise offers or contracts for the performance of the activities that we talked about in 671.520. So the difference between us is that we're a two-license system, as I said. So individuals need to qualify for a license, and there's some pretty rigorous standards in Oregon. And I didn't bring those today. If anyone's curious, I can share that with you. We have a number of exams depending on the type of license that we'll go over in a minute. And they're difficult exams, and that was by design. But recently, the agency worked with a California-based author to design a study guide specific to our exam, which in the past we had applicants with long lists of reference materials in order to prepare for the exam. So I think if you've ever heard it's challenging to get the exam, that's very true. But we're also getting some new resources for folks who want to get licensed. So because an individual passes an exam, it sets the, what we call the phase basis for that licensed business. And we'll talk about the phases in the next slide. All businesses must be licensed, and they can have one or more individuals that set that phase basis. So here's the phases of licensure for us. An all-phase license means that they can do the whole ball of wax. They can do all areas of contracting, they can do irrigation, and they can install backflow devices. A standard license can do everything except irrigation and backflow. And then an irrigation plus backflow means they're limited to those two activities. And then several years ago, there was some interest from CCB licensees to qualify. There was recent legislation that changed our qualifications that made them a little more flexible. But before that, we created a probationary license, which meant you had to get the whole ball of wax. So you had to pass all of the exams, meet all of the standards. You also are on probation for 2 years, so we watch claims experience to make sure that people's inexperience isn't affecting the consumer, and then they have to have our maximum bond amount. So we're trying to hedge the bet for people who didn't come in meeting the original qualifications without license. So as we just talked about, if someone hires a standard licensee, there's a piece of work that they can't do. That means they could hire someone with the irrigation plus backflow, and they complement each other. Then the licensed business can do all phases of landscaping work. So sometimes you'll hear that. People have different licenses, and if they operate outside the phase of license, they can get in trouble with the business. So there's ways that they can work around that. So here's the overlap areas between our agency and the CTB. We went over them a minute ago, but you'll see it's all the exterior. We call them hardscapes, so related to a property. Fences, decks, arbors, patios, landscape edging, driveways, walkways, retaining walls, water features, and drainage systems. The thing that I wanted to make sure that you understand is that our licensees, and some of them were shocked when we did some training in October, so we're working on educating, is that our licensees cannot subcontract some pieces of work. So, for instance, when they build a water feature, they cannot hire the electrician. But what they can do is work with the homeowner, and the homeowner can direct contract with that professional, and then our licensee can basically project manage and schedule the work. But the contract has to be with the homeowner. So we have several exemptions for CCB licensees, which are installation of the dual jurisdiction areas, rough grading of plots and areas of land performed in conjunction with new or remodeling construction, a residential general contractor who performs landscaping work, and the statute allows for an inflation factor. So the current rate is less than $3,400 of landscaping work can be provided by the general if it's a new dwelling and under contract. And then a residential general contractor doing landscaping work related to building code requirements, for instance, street trees, is exempted. But there are no exemptions for irrigation work, just to make that clear. So that's one that sometimes people get hung up on. So we don't have as much overlap with the Building Codes Division. We don't have dual jurisdiction other than our licensees needing to follow their permit processes for work, which is primarily for backflow installation permits. Backflow installation is plumbing work, but our licensees have an exemption from the plumbing code to do that work. And our statutes give the plumbers an exemption for irrigation work, but they can only repair, maintain, or install pipe. They can't install valves and heads, so it limits them. A plumber cannot go in and do a full irrigation system, but they could lay the pipe for that. So we'll talk about continuing ed. You heard about Craig's program. Our program was implemented about the same time we began in 2008, and we talked about a dual license system. This is required for the individuals, not the businesses. So we currently are requiring 16 hours every 2 years of continuing ed, and the programs must be pre-approved by the agency or post-approved within 180 days. So because of the cyclical nature of landscaping, our board recently made that change, so they have 6 months to report to us. So if they're in the middle of working in the field and go earn a couple hours of continuing ed and they don't have time to submit it, there was a 30-day requirement until April 1st. So our board has listened to licensee concerns and given them some additional time. We also had minimum hours for business versus technical hours. That was eliminated, so licensees can take 16 hours in any subject that they're interested in that meets their unique business needs. And our agency on our website provides a list of both online and face-to-face courses, so our licensees can always access that information. So enforcement was a topic of interest today, and it's always a topic of interest with our licensees as well. And some of the feedback you may hear, because we hear it, is that we're only taking action against licensed businesses, and that's not the case. So here's the top 10, and I've noted which ones are against unlicensed individuals. So the first violation is advertising without a license, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. Those are typically unlicensed individuals who are advertising for landscaping work per the definitions we talked about earlier. A business's failure to employ a landscape construction professional. If the individual doesn't meet the continuing education requirement, doesn't renew their license on time, sometimes that gets their business in trouble. So we remind them that on the renewal forms and try to keep folks well informed, but sometimes they don't heed the warnings and it gets the business in trouble. The third violation is failure to notify the agency of an address change. Every newsletter reminds them that they need to do that. Sometimes folks forget and don't do that. Failure to maintain liability insurance. As you all know, having insurance and bond is a critical consumer protection. So the agency takes that very seriously and keeps a close eye on insurance certificate and follows up when they have expired so that we ensure that there's continuous liability insurance coverage. The fifth violation is operating without a license. So we had the list earlier of what was landscaping activities. If we find someone doing those activities, it's operating without a license. And in a few minutes, we'll talk about the agency's incentive that we use with that civil penalty, trying to get people into compliance if we catch them in that situation. Failure to complete CH by the deadline, our continuing education program, unfortunately, as Craig mentioned, some people like it, some people don't. Those that don't sometimes are dragging their heels about complying. So unfortunately, we have to take action. We send our renewal forms out 60 days in advance, so our licensees have plenty of notice, but sometimes folks just don't get it done. Next is failure to have the bond on file, which is similar to insurance. That's the consumer protection piece. We notify, as soon as we've been notified that a bond's been canceled, to let the licensee know, and we have a timeline for response, and it's a pretty tight one because that's something we want to make sure is in place. Insufficient or lack of written contract. Our agency has 11 items that are required in a contract, and all of our licensees need to have those in order to meet them. And then, failure to maintain a bond, and then operating without a license and having a claim filed.
So, looking at this list, are there also more substantive, I have a couple questions, are there also more substantive violations that make it on 11 through 100? I'll explain what I mean.
Okay.
So, I look at, it seems like a lot of the violations are for just failure to fill out the paperwork for the regulations we provided, not that somebody's violating something that is harming a consumer directly. Now, the exceptions would be liability insurance. That seems bad.
Correct.
Right? If you don't have it. Bond, that seems probably pretty bad. No written contract might be kind of bad. The other stuff, like advertising without a license, not having a license, not keeping your license up to date, you know, like the other stuff is just penalties for not having a license. And now, if there's an indicator that those things indicate that somebody is doing good or doing bad, then it's good that we're doing that. But looking at this list, am I making any sense? It looks like we've sort of created a set of laws that violation of the laws themselves are a problem, not necessarily the compliance with the law does any good.
Okay. I'll attempt to answer. And if
right.
I'm not hitting it, please tell me.
All right.
So advertising without a license looks like a pretty meaningless violation, right? Until it's installing an irrigation system or repairing one. And Larry's going to talk a little bit towards the end about what damage water can do. I mean, some of you have had experience with that with friends or neighbors, hopefully not yourself and others haven't. So I hear what you're saying, that some of them appear ambiguous or that they're self-serving for the agency. And I don't think that's the intent.
Exactly.
Okay.
I wouldn't say self-serving. What I'd say is, I guess I'd ask two things. One.
Okay.
11 through 20 is it likely that 11 through 20 are the kind of thing that if we were to see, it looks like it's actually a consumer being harmed. I mean, one question. The second question is, do we have pretty good indication? And you explained we do for the first one. Right, that advertising without a license shows that maybe people are really getting treated badly. Do we have indication that failure to comply with these things, or rather actually violating these things, is also a good indication that person's a bad actor and probably treating consumers badly?
Okay, thank you. So this is enforcement. We also have a claims process, and claims can trigger enforcement action. So claims are where a consumer believes they've been harmed, so they'll file the claim with us and we'll review. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that'll create some of these actions or a lesser infraction that's not as frequent. Our agency doesn't tend to get as many claims as the CCB would because they're a larger agency. I'm still not answering your question well.
I think you did a pretty good job.
Members of the committee.
Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Larry Thomas. I'm a business owner out of Astoria, and I'm the chair of the Landscape Contractors Board. Thank you. Many times in a claims investigation or a situation, we'll find out that permits haven't been pulled. There'll be retaining walls that are leaning into a pedestrian way just about ready to fail. The consumer contacts us,
And in our impending site visit and interviews, we discover there have been no permits. And in the municipal jurisdiction where this property is, they require permits. And failure to pull permits is a violation we take action on.
Did we hit your question, Representative Smith?
Roughly, and all I'd say is it seems incumbent upon us to try to make this stuff as, you know, simple and teeth-worthy as possible.
Okay. Thank you.
But I understand what you're saying is a lot of these violations are oftentimes triggered as the result of a claim that's been filed.
Correct. They can be. That's right. And just to give you a feel for scope, because I think part of your question, if I heard it right, Representative Smith, was scope. So in the last 18 months, the violation number 10, we actually have 10 of those cases. So we haven't had a lot, and when you get to 11 through 100, there's not as many of them. Okay. But some of them may be a little bit more severe than what these appear.
Okay.
Thank you. So we talked, you heard about the CCB and their level of investigations. Our agency has been dwindled down to one full-time staff investigator. We rely on 7 contract investigators across the state, which the advantage of that is they give us some pretty good reach across the state. We used licensed private investigators to do the work for us. And just for your information, the majority of our investigations, probably at least 90% of them, if not more, begin with a report from a licensee or a member of the general public. We don't have the staff capacity to drive neighborhoods and find people doing illegal landscaping work. So we rely on other folks to report that. Our LCB investigator does check Craigslist when time allows across the state looking for violations, but we also have a number of licensees who are very diligent about watching Craigslist on our behalf as well. As you know, the recession has affected our industry and the construction industry pretty dramatically, and folks are hungry and they're trying to protect their livelihoods. So we have some help in that area. What we do in-house is our staff investigator researches the information that's been provided, and if there's enough information, dispatches a contract investigator if it's outside the area and we can't get there in a reasonable amount of time. We also, Representative Holvey was involved with the creation of the Interagency Compliance Network. We're an active partner, and where appropriate, if we have cases, we take them to the ICN for review and compliance. As Craig mentioned, we also work with Department of Revenue, CCB in local jurisdictions if there's a case that involves any infractions with our licensees as we're out and doing investigations. So one of the interesting things is for our agency, we were talking about a minute ago, is advertising violations. So ORS 671-534 states that a person can't advertise or represent themselves as a landscape contracting business unless they hold a valid license. And our rules also are very descriptive about our written advertising jurisdiction. As of July 1, we have limited staff capacity to research Craigslist. As I said, we cut a half-time investigator, so we aren't as active with that as we used to be. And then ORS 671-997 dictates to us that our folks shall forfeit and pay to our agency a civil penalty in an amount determined by the board of not more than $2,000 for each offense. And we've gotten, in prior years, our Attorney General's advice on that language and take it very literally, which can be issues in cases. We don't have the ability to negotiate. Our civil penalty structure, we'll talk a little bit more in a lot, isn't at $2,000, and I'll tell you about where our board has given us flexibility to settle cases and the thinking behind that. So the other issue that we talked about with unlicensed is operating as a landscape contracting business or professional. Again, that starts with a report from an external individual, typically a licensee. They're out in the field driving around looking for work and seeing folks doing their work that may or may not be licensed. Our staff investigator does as much front-end work as possible to ensure that when we send someone to a property, we know that there's possibly a violation. So he checks any car license registrations to make sure it's not an owner working on their own property. We don't want to go out and interrupt that. He wants to find out if the work is actually legal landscaping work. We don't go out and inspect sites where it's just maintenance, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And if it's a licensed landscape company doing work within their phase basis, we don't want to interfere with that. So if there is a potential violation and we take action, we get evidence, we actually send a notice of civil penalty and use the contested case process to walk through that process with them. So they have an opportunity to respond. They have an opportunity to refute any evidence the agency may have. And it goes to the Office of Administrative Hearings if they request that. The final step in the appeal process is an exemption filed with our board. So civil penalties, we talked about a minute ago, we can penalize up to $2,000. Our agency penalty structure has typically a lower penalty amount for first offenses than second, so we like to give people a learning opportunity and educate them if we catch them doing something that's a violation. There's three areas that as staff we can settle with folks. First is the advertising violation. It's a $500 civil penalty. We can settle that for $125. Again, we see that as an opportunity to educate folks and get them knowledgeable about the laws. An operating violation, we talked about a minute ago, is a $1,000 civil penalty for a first offense. If someone is willing and interested to get licensed with us, we can lower that to $250. They get a six-month window to work on getting licensed. We can extend that if we need to. So we really try to work with people to understand and comply with the law. If there's someone that for whatever reason is not interested or not willing to get licensed, we can settle that for $750 and they promise not to landscape again, to stick to maintenance or unlicensed activity. An address change is sometimes when our licensees get their dander up a little bit, which is a $200 civil penalty, and we can settle that for $50. We're just really trying to make sure our address of record is accurate, so if there is any administrative action, we know how to reach them with that offense. So I just wanted to inform the committee a little bit about our civil penalty collections process. Our agency, the first step is to work with any infractor and do collections in-house. So we have folks that make very small payments to us on a regular basis, and we work with them to the best of their and our ability. We accept monthly payments, so we're not out to bankrupt anyone or create financial hardship. We'll work with folks. Then if we have an account that doesn't attempt to pay or they stop paying as agreed without working with the agency notifying, we send them either to Department of Revenue or a private collection agency. And we are finding that a private collection seems to be more effective for our folks for whatever reason. Department of Revenue hasn't been as successful in the most recent year. So. Then I'm going to ask Larry to talk about why landscaping's licensed. Some people ask that question. Why is this so important?
Plants and especially trees, but many plants can cause property damage. I'll give you an example. It's not uncommon for a 2,000-pound tree to be planted on site. It's improperly planted and not anchored to the ground. The slightest wind can blow it over. It could be 30 feet tall, hitting vehicles or a structure. Irrigation systems can malfunction and damage property. Recently in Portland in the last few years, there was a malfunctioning irrigation system that was determined to have caused a landslide that damaged four homes. Water systems can be damaged with the without backflow devices on your irrigation systems, allowing bacteria to come into the municipal water. And then the neighboring properties are affected as they draw water. Grading and drainage can affect consumer property as well as neighboring property. Improper grading or lack of grading can direct water into foundation vents and basement stairwells, causing water damage and dry rot. Landscaping is an improvement to consumers as they invest in their property. You know, we can install landscapes that are cost $500 to $500,000. And consumers expect consumer protection and some sort of recourse if they have a problem. And that's what the licensing system that we have addresses.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Is there questions from the committee? Representative Wisnett.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Sneed, do your penalties go back to your agency or do they go to the general fund?
They do. We're semi-independent.
They go to the agency?
They go to the agency. We don't have any general fund support, so they do.
Follow up.
for it.
Mrs. Sneed, well, first for Mr. Thomas and Mrs. Sneed, I think I supported landscape recreation of the board, and I think I approved or supported the giving you responsibility for backflow. So it's in my legislature. So before I give you the questions, Mrs. Sneed, and I've had meetings before. The contractors board has a $600 fine for advertising or submitting a bid to do work as a contractor, which may be reduced to $200 if the respondent becomes licensed, or $50 if the advertisement or bid is withdrawn immediately upon notification from an agency that a violation has occurred and no work is accepted as a result of the advertisement or bid. Your penalty is, I think for my constituent, you've charged him $500 and then agreed to maybe lower that. And I guess you're now saying that your board has given you authority to go down to 125, is that correct?
Correct.
Also, when,
follow up,
when my constituent received your letter, it said if he didn't pay, he's going to put a lien on his house. Is that really necessary? Do other people do that too?
Representative Wisnett, our agency, like many probably that do civil penalties, have a variety of collection tools. We definitely don't take a lien on a property if we don't have to. So our first, as we mentioned, if it's a case we can settle and the respondent works with us, we settle it. We'll take reasonable monthly payments if the respondent's willing and able to do that. If not, we send it to a collection agency and or depending on if the licensee has another license, sometimes the other jurisdiction will comply and will suspend a license until there's compliance with our enforcement action. So taking a lien on someone's property is very low on our collection scheme.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
So I guess my question is, with our case that you and I met with and discussed, you're saying that you didn't think the board gave you authority to go down to this, you know, $125. Is that correct? And now you have that authority? Is that?
No, I did have the authority at that time to work with that individual. He wasn't willing to communicate with the agency, if I recall correctly.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Your board gives you authority to reduce this $500 fine to how much?
To $125.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Contractors board has authority to go to $50.
And I will tell you, Representative Wisnett, that our board is currently in discussions about letting staff have the ability to settle and negotiate at different rates. The rules currently in place are as we discussed today. But because of the economy, because of the nature of what's going on, the board is working with staff on that, and we're looking at other agencies and their experience. So we're collecting that information, looking at revising that practice.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I make one? So thank you for that comment. And I think in our conversation, I think intent has to be entered into this. And I think also you have to look at if the individual made money. If he made money, that's one situation. If the individual didn't make money, that's another situation. It was just careless error or those things. So I appreciate it, and I would hope you keep me involved as you work on changing this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to clarify, as I was installing a drip irrigation system at my house yesterday, any of the things we're talking about today, an individual citizen can perform on his or her house their own.
That's correct. It's for compensation.
Thank you.
What if you didn't get that answer?
You'd what you want to
well, be getting a fine in the mail, I guess, if I didn't get that answer.
My wife did.
So I appreciate your thorough overview. I do have one question in regards to the landscape contractors and the doing some of the shared construction contractor board work. And when we talk about decks and fences and sometimes arbors, I assume many of them attach to the house. And I don't remember in our construction claims task force review of the building envelope issues whether or not they have building envelope education requirements for landscape contractors.
We don't We don't have any mandated coursework, but many of the folks that are dual licensed with CCB can submit that program for approval through our continuing ed program. Mm. So some of them are using that education.
My concern was there is because in 2005 and 2007, when we heard many of these issues around moisture intrusion, many of the problems were related to decks being attached to the house and fences being bolted into the side of the house without proper protection of the building envelope, where, and then that caused rot and, you know, some things like that. So I just have a little bit of concern there that some of our educational requirements may be not really hitting the right people sometimes. And then on the flip side, with the Construction Contractors Board, I kind of wonder about the efficacy of having excavating contractors, and I'm not sure if they're classified as commercial or residential, having to have that building envelope training as well. Understand that grade is important, but I think the building codes, maybe we'll hear, you know, require grade slope away from house, and that seems like a pretty easy educational requirement for an excavator as opposed to having the whole building envelope. I'd be interested in having that conversation, I suppose, with the board as well, to see if there's some way to, soften up those building envelope requirements on excavators that don't really seem to touch the building envelope. I'll give you a chance to rebut that.
No rebuttal necessary. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Craig Smith, I will be happy to take this conversation that we've had here today to the board. I know they have talked about it over and over again. The fact that you'd be interested in seeing some modification to that may be instrumental in moving the board the direction that makes sense. So I'll be happy to share that with them.
Yeah, and I'm not absolutely certain. It just seems like excavation is, you know, if you got your grade right and it's required by the building codes, and the excavators are trained in that. Seems like it might be a little onerous to have the whole building envelope educational requirements for an excavation company specifically. I'll have to think about that some more and have some more conversations and be interested in your board's take on that. Mr. Long, Mr.
Chair, I'm sorry, I had one question real quick.
Go ahead.
Mrs. Sneed, is your board or your are you aware of the Executive Order 12-05? Have you had any input into that?
I think I was as surprised about that as Craig was, so
thank
we'll
you.
Do some research. Thank you, Representative.
And it gives me an opportunity to ask one more question for the Landscape Contractors Board. Are there, in defining, for example, arbors and patios and decks and retaining walls, are there limitations on those, like how big of a retaining wall does a landscape contractor board license allow you to put in?
Members of the committee, landscape contractors have to comply with the U.S. National Building Code and the local building codes and go through the permit process. Generally, a 4-foot retaining wall does not require a permit, but sometimes it does, depending on the surcharge behind the wall or the drainage issues, or in my case, in Astoria, many, many designated landslide areas in the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. So as far as arbors and decks, does that include greenhouses, outbuildings, those sorts of things?
It does not, Representative Holby.
Okay, thank you. I think we better move on to Mr. Long, or we won't get to the next part of our agenda. Mr. Long, you cover some licensing yourself that does seem to overlap with the Construction Contractors Board and the Landscape Contractors Board, evidently. So I'd like you to give us your little presentation on your licensing.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. I'm just going to give you some quick background. I'll be respectful of your time. I think I can get through this very quickly. First of all, the purpose of our organization is safe buildings, so that's in the context in which we adopt codes and perform licensing functions. For the members of the committee that aren't familiar with the organization, you have a unique system here. We set statewide policy on code. The code that I adopt, and I'll get to licensing, but the code that I adopt is uniform statewide. It's both the minimum standard and the maximum standard. We're one of only a couple states that provide that. What that does is provide uniform protection on the safety side, but also a uniform regulatory environment on the business side. And we spend quite a bit of our time working on those two issues. We have seven advisory boards that help us set the standards that work with my agency. Some of them have direct policy setting when it comes to licensing enforcement, and then some are advisory when it comes to the code and some of the technical provisions. We do license individuals and contractors. Some of the difference is I have 34 different individual license types that fall along trade areas. It's usually in the subcontractor area, so we're talking about plumbers, electricians, folks who work on boilers, elevators, those types of equipment. And then I have 16 different business types that line up with those individual crafts that we oversee at state building codes. We also carry out enforcement. We address complaints that come in from a variety of sources. A lot of it comes from local government through the permit process and working directly with the contractors. And then we do have six enforcement officers that conduct investigations and do outreach. The things on enforcement, and then I'll pick up on overlap, but primarily on enforcement, our kind of policy objectives right now are consistency between the boards, having four different licensing boards, seven overall. You want to make sure that the issues around testing, application, education are consistent. We work very hard to bring those in line, that you have enforcement consistency so that the penalties we issue in one area are consistent with the penalties we issue for another specialty area. And we want to make sure that if you have multiple penalties, they violated electrical provision and a plumbing provision, that we can resolve some of those disputes, those issues quite quickly. The other area that we're working from a policy standpoint is strengthening the connections between our organization and CCB. We've worked over the years to address the dual licensing nature. It's been around for some time. We can take action on violations of the CCB license. They can take action on violations of our license, including permit. Craig talked about that. We refer a lot of cases together, and we coordinate more now than ever across the agencies. We want to make sure the other area that we're focusing on right now is to make sure related laws are being followed, not only when we're going out and looking at our individual issues, do they indeed have the CCB license? Don't get into the landscaping stuff so much in the areas that we're in, but we're looking at workers' comp, looking at other areas within our department, make sure that Secretary of State licensure, as an example, is followed, and we try to take a holistic approach to our view, making sure that we're not only looking at our provisions, but we're kind of reaching out and representing statewide issues as well. Second to the last issue we're working on right now is to make sure that we have consistency of the tools that we have in our toolbox to take enforcement actions with those four different boards and four different industries that have primarily kind of siloed their activity. We want to make sure that we have all the enforcement tools, whether it's revocation, suspension, investigation, conditions, all those kind of things kind of across the board. We're making sure that everything's equal and even. We're trying to harmonize some of the activity, even though it is broken down by specialty craft. And then the last piece, and this kind of gets at Representative Smith's question earlier, we really are focusing on outcomes. Yes, we go after advertising, and yes, we go after permit violations, and yes, we go after licensing violations, but we're trying to figure out, was the installation unsafe? Who did you put in harm? How many? And then that factors into the enforcement action that we take, whether it's corrective action or the level of the fine. And then we look to see if the consumer was harmed and in situations where they may get into the issue of having to pay twice. So contractor A did a poor, I hate to pick on the plumbers, but did a poor plumbing installation. Consumer has to go get another contractor to come in and fix it. We make sure contractor A is taking care of that problem one way or the other, and we use that in the factor of the fine that we assess, how they left that consumer and the condition of that job. So I really call that kind of outcome-based focusing on our enforcement efforts, and it really requires quite a bit of thinking within our shop about how to approach these issues. This is relatively new, but we think that it provides a little bit additional value in addition to our standard business regulatory functions. Overlap, again, our subcontractors get licensed by CCB. It really breaks down to this. If you contract for services, you're going to be licensed by CCB or one of the other entities. If you perform very specialized subcontractor work that has a safety component that attaches to the codes that I adopt, like electricians, plumbers, folks in the elevator industry and boiler industry, we're going to license you individually, as well as license those business so we can have some connections between the workers and the business owners and be able to take enforcement action when there's a safety component that's at the heart of the issue. With that, because you're running up against the clock, I will leave plenty of time for questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Smith.
Sir, you said about outcomes. How is that encouraged structurally? What I heard you say was we keep outcomes in mind when we impose enforcement actions. How do we keep it in mind? Or what other things are we doing to help encourage an outcomes-based culture?
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Smith, first of all, it's new, last several months. So we're in the beginning stages of it, but we've had some success. We also work with our boards to create a matrix that lays out the kinds of things, similar to what you saw for landscape contractor, the types of things that are out there, what do we want the penalty amounts and the action to be, and we're adding these kinds of elements to that discussion. But I'm not here to tell you that it's done or that it's fully part of the fabric of our organization. I shared with you those kind of 6 bullet points, things that we're working on right now to improve our efforts and provide additional value and enforcement.
Follow-up comment, Mr. Chair?
So I guess I'd encourage that. I'd applaud that it's become a part of the testimony. I would urge that it become even more part of the, you know, conduct, and that we think about how, and it might also be trying to connect the dots between, right, not an expensive study, but just sort of quick and dirty tracking of how, you know, is a person who's licensed and bonded, you know, how what is their customer satisfaction, maybe linked to some of the technology stuff, versus what is the customer satisfaction of the people who ain't, right? And what is the incidence of mal events in either context? It does seem to me, I'd rather have an unlicensed person do a good job than a licensed person do a bad job. And not that I'm encouraging there to be unlicensed folks, but I want to make sure folks are doing a good job.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Smith, you're exactly right. That's the type of discussion that we're having in the agency the last several months. I'd be happy to kind of talk to you about some of our ideas. Not a lot of data yet because it's new. It's in addition to those standard kind of prescriptive things,
sure,
that are the standard business regulatory pieces. And I absolutely agree with you. It's the outcome that matters. So we look at, again, did that individual, whether they're licensed or not, put somebody in harm? How many people? What type of situation? I get pretty aggressive if it's a school or a large institution versus maybe some other kind of situation where the risk to the public is not as much. So, again, it's hard to quantify that. I can certainly talk about it. We can have the policy discussion here. I wanted you to know that's something that we've recognized over the course of the last few months, and we're really trying to make that paradigm shift within our organization.
Thanks. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mark, thank you for being here, obviously, for a long period of time and getting to this point. You mentioned an example of plumber A, plumber B, and trying to fix that. Recently, I've been having several conversations with contractors and people in commercial buildings and trying to see what we can do to improve the efficiency within government agencies and approving plans. Can you tell me a little bit example of what your involvement is with public agencies? For example, when one set of plans is submitted to approve an electrical plan with fire exits in one spot, and then plumber B, the inspector, says, no, I want it over here, and these contractors are sitting there throwing their arms up. How does your department, or maybe you don't, maybe there's something we need to talk about offline to try to consolidate some of these things for accountability.
Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Kamen, plenty to talk offline because there's several things I'd be happy to talk to you about. It really depends on what the issue is. If it's an area that's under our jurisdiction, we regulate the inspectors and the building officials as well. You didn't ask me to come here to talk about that. And so if we have an inspector or a building official that's under our jurisdiction that requires something that's outside of the adopted standard, we can take action. We have the ability to take action if it's another government entity, maybe a special district, those kinds of things. When it comes to how things, the overlap between agencies, you kind of mentioned the fire component. We've talked about the licensing overlap here. There are some code and standard and inspection overlaps between my organization, DHS, Fire Service, and some other components. And again, I don't think it's DHS anymore. But anyway, be happy to talk to you about those if you'd like at some point. We work on it all the time.
Thank you.
Okay.
We got to work on it.
Real quick. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Long, as Administrator of the Building Codes Division, are you familiar with Executive Order 12-05? Did you have any input into that?
I'm familiar. I don't have any input.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Long, I'm just curious. You made reference to all the boards and commissions. How many boards, commissions, sub-agencies are underneath the Building Codes Division?
I have, Mr. Chair, I have 7 boards that are within my division. They are statutorily created, and most of the positions are confirmed by the Senate. About 4 of those boards, off the top of my head, have what I would call policy setting on the licensing enforcement. They act like a licensing board because they have independent decision-making there. And then all of the boards, when it comes to code and technical matters and other administrative matters, similar to what Representative Cameron was talking about, we work in harmony. They're advisory to my office. And just to give you further, it breaks down along the areas of construction. So I don't want to bore the committee, and I'll probably miss somebody, and then they'll read something into that. But mechanical board for mechanical issues. We have a residential that focuses on residential-related aspects in manufactured housing, commercial building, electrical, plumbing, boiler. I think there's an energy. Hopefully that was 7.
And Mr. Smith, the same question to you. How many boards and commissions, agencies are within the CCB?
So the question is, how many separate little boards and commissions are with the agency? We're a licensing agency, so we license all construction contractors. We have some various types of smaller organizations. We have a separate committee for locksmiths. We have a committee for home inspectors. We have a variety of other specialty folks that look at things. But for the most part, we have one agency, one board that oversees all 40,000 construction contractors.
Who has a structural board?
I do.
You forgot it.
So I think
you left it out.
I probably said commercial, which is the structural. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Just looking for one, that's all.
As I think what we're talking about with structure, we're talking about building codes development.
That's correct.
Building codes, they divide building codes into various little aspects, and of course that makes a lot of sense to do so.
Thank you. I think we've pretty much exhausted everybody with the with a pretty thorough overview of I guess, the industry licensing. I appreciate you coming in and giving us this overview, so it will inform us better on how to set any policy in the future if we do, and look forward to ongoing conversations.
Great. Thank you.
I did want to give the opportunity to, if he so chose, Dean Owens from the Oregon Real Estate Agency, if you cared to comment on any of the conversation that we had. Not necessary, but certainly if I know you were on the agenda and have been sitting here diligently.
Representative Colby, co-chair, and the committee, I have nothing to do.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've had a request for a 5-minute break. We'll be back up in 5 minutes. We'll recess for 5 minutes.
It's been denied.
Who the heck wrote me that request?
like to reconvene the House Interim Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection for Monday, May 21st. For the second topic today, we're going to be talking a bit about foreclosures in the state of Oregon and some of the recent legislation that has been implemented and how we're poised to go into the future to help distressed homeowners. So with that, I think I'll call up Keith Dubanovich from the Department of Justice, and you could start out with your presentation.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is Keith Dubanovich, and I'm Associate Attorney General. With the Chair's permission, I'll focus first on mortgage loan servicing rules and then come back to the implementation of Senate Bill 1552, since Ms. Van Vliet will be addressing that issue after I'm done. So let me start out by talking about mortgage loan servicing rules. As the committee is well aware, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act is the primary consumer protection law in the state of Oregon. Until 2010, that law did not apply to loans or extensions of credit. In 2010, the legislature passed 3706, which extended the application of the UTPA to loans and extensions of credit. Let me digress for a moment to talk about what mortgage loan servicing is. Essentially, you borrow money from a bank. They assign the servicing rights, the handling rights, to another entity that is responsible for making sure that your checks are deposited in the right account, that they appropriately account for the deposit of the funds. And so the servicer is the entity that most consumers have contact with. We have had a large number of complaints about mortgage loan servicers. They've increased quite substantially over the last 4 years. And part of the problem is the homeowner has no choice in who their servicer is, and indeed that assignment may be transferred to different servicers during the course of their loan, adding to consumer confusion. Over the last couple of years, we've also seen a substantial change in the marketplace as banks have gone near their own foreclosure and been absorbed by other banks, and then the servicing rights have had to be changed and reassigned. A lot of the responsibility for management of the loans has been outsourced. So as a consequence, we've seen a lot of problems with poor document management, untrained workers, lack of oversight. And unfortunately, the federal government has not been properly monitoring the servicers in this state or around the country either. And until House Bill 3706 was passed, there was no Oregon entity that had any kind of regulatory oversight at all over mortgage loan servicers. As this chart reflects, we've received over 2,000 consumer complaints about mortgage loan servicers just since 2008. Obviously, that's a large number, and it puts them at the top of our list, not number one, but very close to the top of the list. The types of complaints we get are fairly common year to year, and that is that the servicer tells the homeowner to stop paying, and then they go into foreclosure because they stopped paying, even though the homeowner had the ability to continue to pay their mortgage. We have seen a number of cases where late fees were assessed, notwithstanding the fact that the payments were timely made. We've seen late fees diverted to a different account. We've had a lot of confusion about the loan modification process. And obviously, one of the biggest complaints we've had is the dual track problem. Somebody perceives that they are going down the path of getting a loan modification, and they get a notice of foreclosure in the mail. So the Department of Justice has some rulemaking authority. It is not extraordinarily broad, but it is out of the Administrative Procedures Act, and then specifically the provisions in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act provide authority to the Attorney General to define rules that prohibit certain kinds of misleading or deceptive practices. The Department of Justice from time to time propounds rules. For example, we have rules about gas price advertising. We have rules involving mobile home manufacturing. So there are a lot of different rules that we propound under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Earlier this year, we adopted some rules regarding mortgage loan servicers. That rule is temporary in nature and will expire in July of this year. And the intent was to provide some guidance for homeowners and the industry about what our expectations are. If we didn't pass any rules, the business sector and the department would be stuck with trying to figure out what is an unconscionable practice. And rather than be stuck with that vague and ambiguous term, we adopted some fairly specific rules that prohibit certain conduct. And that is, for example, you cannot assess a late fee for an on-time payment. You cannot assess or collect default fees if they're not authorized by the servicing agreement. You must follow certain basic federal standards, and it is improper to misrepresent any material information regarding a loan modification. And last but not least, a servicer must deal with its customer, its borrower, in good faith. So as I said, those temporary rules are in effect until July. And as a consequence, we recognized at the very beginning that we needed to pass some permanent rules that would provide guidance to the industry and homeowners about what's expected in the state of Oregon. Simultaneous with that, the Department of Justice in Oregon, along with 48 other states in the District of Columbia, entered into one of the largest multi-state settlements in history. A major component of that settlement was a consent judgment which includes some very specific guidelines for servicer conduct. And those guidelines are filed in federal court. They're enforceable by not only the Department of Justice, but also by an independent monitor. However, that consent decree expires after 3.5 years and only covers 5 of the largest servicers that do business in the state. And there are a lot of other servicers that are not impacted by those servicing standards. So as a consequence, what we envisioned were similar standards that would apply to everyone in the industry, therefore leveling the playing field, and standards that would apply after the 3.5 year consent decree expires. This is a rough outline of what the proposed servicing rules would do. Again, fairly similar to what we did in the initial temporary rules, and that is you cannot misapply the mortgage payments. Because a lot of the problems that we initially started investigating arose out of what was called robo-signing, and that is signing of false affidavits in pursuit of a foreclosure, we felt it appropriate to be real clear that under Oregon law, it's illegal to file and sign a false affidavit. So there are fairly specific guidelines that we propose. And they are, again, modeled after the servicer standards that the 5 largest banks have already agreed to. Again, the goal is to curb the widespread abuse in the industry, to develop consistency so that every business is complying with the same standards. We don't want there for a particular company to have an unfair advantage. And we simply want fairness in the industry for consumers. So the rulemaking process is fairly simple. We've developed a proposal. We've given notice. Chair Holvey, Representative Sheehan has a question.
Representative Sheehan, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When does the 3.5 year time period start for the settlement? Because I know some of those programs aren't online yet.
Correct. The 3.5 year period, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Sheehan, the 3.5 year time period is applicable for the servicing standards. For the settlement benefits, some of those are already in effect and taking place. In other words, the loan modification benefits are already in effect. The principal write-down benefits are already being in effect for some of the servicers. And those benefits will continue for 3 years, starting in, I think it was early March of this year.
Thank you.
So returning to the PowerPoint slides, there are 5 simple steps to rulemaking: develop a proposal, which we did, again, based upon the servicer standards that the 5 major banks have agreed to. We've given notice to the public. We will have 2 public hearings, one in Portland and one here in Salem. And we solicit public comment, and by mid-July, we intend to adopt and file the final rule with the Secretary of State. Again, one of the goals was to make sure that we had as broad an outlook on these rules as we could possibly get, and in an effort to recognize who might be impacted by the rules, we convened an advisory committee to make sure that we were doing appropriate outreach regarding the rules. The members of this stakeholders committee included consumer attorneys, members of the business community, the banking community, title companies, realtors, et cetera, et cetera. So we made a concerted effort to make sure that we made a good faith effort at reaching out to those entities that might be impacted so that we could gain their benefit in identifying who else should be invited to the public hearings. Those public hearings have been set for June, and the notice will be going out in the Secretary of State's bulletin. As I said, we've already drafted the basic rules. The public hearings are set, and our goal is to have final rules become effective in late July when the temporary rules expire. Any questions?
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dubanovich, it says that the consent decree, the consent agreement was supposed to be the five companies, but the rules we're doing is all those people servicing loans. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, that's correct.
Thank you.
The consent decree only applies to five servicers. The rules we're proposing apply to every servicer that services a loan in the state of Oregon.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Most of the ones that are the biggest problems, I guess, with the big five banks, they're national banks. Are our rules going to be consistent with Washington State, California, Idaho, so that the banks, you know, don't have to worry about each state or service, the servicers, as it?
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, there are no national standards. And the states that have adopted standards, to the best of my understanding, are North Carolina and New York. Obviously, the 48 states that joined with Oregon have the same basic standards that apply to the five banks. If and when there are some national standards that would take effect, we would certainly follow the lead, as we have done in other rulemaking areas, which is that the federal law would control unless state law was more stringent. And I think that's the intent of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's my understanding they may be proposing rules, but it's unclear whether they will do so or not.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. If you'd like to move on to the next segment.
I can figure out how to do that. I'd be happy to.
As you're doing that, sir, so these rules are not 1552 or the settlement. They're back to the
3706.
Are they 3706? Is that?
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey, the rules that we're contemplating come under 3706, and they are independent of the mediation program.
Thank you.
Okay. Mike? With me is Mike Niemeyer, who, fortunately for me, is truly the expert on mediation in the state of Oregon. He is our appropriate dispute resolution coordinator in the state of Oregon, so he will be assisting me with the presentation on this issue. By way of background, the committee may recall that you passed a bill literally in the last hours of the February session that requires large volume home servicers to enter into mediation with borrowers prior to commencing a non-judicial foreclosure. The bill was signed into law by the governor, and it takes effect on July 11 of this year. The key provisions include elimination of the dual track problem. Obviously, as I mentioned earlier in my presentation, we get a lot of complaints about homeowners that aren't clear on whether they're going down the loan modification avenue or are they facing foreclosure. But the other major aspect is the existence of mandatory mediation. And essentially, as I understand your intent, it's to get the servicer and the homeowner in a room together with an independent third-party mediator in an effort to resolve the foreclosure issue. It may be a deed in lieu. It may be a timely and safe exit from the property for the homeowner. It may be a loan modification. But the goal is to get the two people in a room to together to have a conversation. One important provision to note is that there is an exemption for entities that do not do 250 foreclosure actions in a given calendar year. And that was recognized because, as Chair Wisnett has already indicated, those smaller entities generally have not been the precipitator of complaints to our database. Most of the complaints involve the large servicers. The Attorney General has been given responsibility for designing and overseeing the program, and we have been hard at work doing so. This chart is more complicated than I have the ability to explain, which is why Mr. Niemeyer is here.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, for the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the Alternative Dispute Resolution Coordinator at the Department of Justice. I won't explain this in detail. It violates every PowerPoint rule that was ever created in terms of font size and complexity, but the point here is just to let you know the level of rigor that we're dealing with this program at. This program is going to be scaled within 90 days to handle 1,500 home foreclosure mediations each month, and that each process is going to involve a homeowner, a lender, a mediator, a mediation service provider, and housing counselors. The only way for us to do this efficiently is through a database system, and we are working with a private contractor, the mediation service provider, that will deliver this platform that provides an interface to exchange documents electronically and be able to schedule the mediations, provide the notices, and manage the timelines in an efficient way. So this is just meant to illustrate the level of rigor that we need to go through to get that scaled up.
The first thing I did when I saw that you had passed 1552 is sit down with the bill and underline everything that indicates that we at the Department of Justice had some responsibility. And this is the list that then immediately gave me a headache, because we had to do all this in 91 days. As you can imagine, we put our track shoes on and we have been scrambling ever since. The good news is that we have the assistance of some really, really great community members, which we'll get to in a second.
And those work groups have broken into subcommittees to do the heavy lifting. This is the project timeline that we've developed to get this all accomplished in 90 days. And just note that there's a number of themes here. One is the setting up the fiscal side of it, which is a separate account. We've got rulemaking, which we need to conduct in that period of time. We need to procure a statewide mediation service provider through contract. We need to conduct training of housing counselors and mediators. We need to engage our community partners to be able to help engage the homeowners, and we need to establish a system for evaluating the program.
The good news is that we are not actually inventing the wheel. A number of other states have already created a mediation program. We have gone to school on them, both learning what's successful and what is not. And amazingly, almost contemporaneous with the passage of this bill, the U.S. Department of Justice issued a report involving foreclosure mediation, and simultaneously with your session in February, the National Consumer Law Center issued a report that also involved foreclosure mediation. So we've really had the great benefit of good timing and good resources from other states and the U.S. Department of Justice and the Consumer Law Center. So let me talk about the work group. The recognition from the very beginning was that we had a lot of work to do, and there was no way that we could do it all by ourselves, and we didn't have the complete expertise within the Department of Justice to do it. So we created a work group, and obviously with any work group, you start with a charter to make sure that everybody is on the same page. We defined the scope of the work. We recognized that because we were not doing permanent rulemaking, we could not adhere to the normal schedule for permanent rulemaking. We will be doing temporary rules initially, followed up by permanent rules after we've got the program up and running so that we can become educated on the actual operations of the program. We wanted to make sure that we had broad representation of our steering committee. We also obviously wanted to invite the public to attend and participate. and to make sure that the work group actually works on time and get its work done during the meetings, we have a facilitator who has agreed to volunteer his time to keep the meetings working on schedule. The work group members obviously include consumer representatives, debtors, mediation associations, attorney mediators, federal court mediators, regulatory agencies, housing counselors, title companies, financial institutions, members of the legislature. From the very beginning, we reached out to anyone who was a co-sponsor of the bill to invite them to participate so that we could gain broad support and information. As Mike indicated, we have a number of subcommittees. We recognized from the very beginning that we couldn't do everything in the broad steering committee, so we assigned specific tasks to these various subcommittees that met on a weekly basis for a while, and there were a lot of late-night email and telephone conversations that were taking place among members of the committees. So turning to methodology.
So this slide is a logic model. You're going to either love this or hate it. I'll try and explain why you should maybe love it. But the ideas, and from your earlier discussion, I appreciate your interest in outcome-based programs and that we manage state programs to achieve outcomes, not just crank out widgets. And so this is an attempt to, by a logic model, articulate the steps that we believe are necessary to achieve the outcomes. And this helps us in two respects. One is it illustrates and makes transparent the program theory. So, for example, you'll hear that we believe that housing counseling is an important component of this. We want to be able to look at dose, what level of housing counseling is important to make this work, what are the other steps that are important. So this and the next page are meant to illustrate the program theory that we believe is necessary to achieve the outcomes for the state. So there are the state level, and this is the case level outcome slide that you see now, so that there are things we believe are necessary. The homeowner and the lender are going to need access to good information. The lender is going to need to know what the status of the homeowner is in terms of their financial situation. And the benefit or the grantor or the homeowner is going to need to know what their options are. So good information, for example, leads to a good mediation process and then the outcomes that we hope to achieve. And these are described a little bit on the next slides here as well. So in terms of a good mediation process, these are the things that we expect of our contractor. This is a program that the Department of Justice is going to have a very small footprint on. We're hiring a contractor to run this program, and these are the outcomes that we expect, and we'll hold that contractor to. Next slide here.
Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnett, question.
Thank you. Mr. Niedermeyer, back on your desired state-level outcome. Looks good. That's what we're, you know, all the tax money, taxpayers' money should be looking at something like this. It's key to audit this as we go through. Have you arranged to have someone say, well, here's a problem. We're not getting this. That's infecting everything. If you don't have enough, you know, outreach, the people are not getting the word out to the people. Do you have some way that you've let, you know, put an audit in here to look at this periodically or in these, you know, to look at the whole thing?
Co-Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Wisnett, exactly. We're monitoring this at a number of levels. So there are some of these measures get to just client satisfaction and those kind of things we can deal with in terms of exit surveys. Other things, we need to figure out what the actual benchmarks are and what we need to attain here to measure some of these outcomes, and we'll get that with some experience here. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair. But that's good. But again, you know, we need to do it as we're going through. We don't need to wait till the end. So, well, we failed. You know, if we need to put more money in outreach, and I guess you just got back from the e-board, or we need to put more counselors, or, you know, something like that, I hope that some way we can, someone's sitting back and looking at this thing and saying, okay, yeah, we're getting people coming into Medford, they're not coming into Bend, things like that.
Co-Chair, yeah. Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, yes, the measurement is at one level is dynamic, and as I mentioned, the computer system that we have will give us dynamic reports. We're very interested in participation rates. We found that in other states, the critical element here is the degree to which homeowners are aware of the program and participate in this. And in terms of program improvement, we're going to want to carefully monitor that to see if we need a couple more phone calls, someone to go knock on a door in order to increase those participation rates. We've set benchmarks for the contractor that they must achieve in terms of homeowner participation, and that's definitely one that we're going to closely monitor.
Thank you.
And further follow-up, Representative Holby, Representative Wisnett, we will be forming an advisory committee that will be monitoring not only the performance of the mediation services provider, but the program as a whole. As we've indicated in the outcomes portion here, obviously the goal, to the extent that we can have any control over it, is to maximize the number of people that are kept in their home. But the reality is that that may not be the right outcome in every case. Nonetheless, through the use of technology, we are obviously going to be able to track the outcome. So if the outcome is somebody get to stay in their home, we'll be able to differentiate how many of those people saw a housing counselor. We'll be able to see, you know, what are the predictors of success, so that when we finally do sit down to propose permanent rules, we will be benefited by the actual experience of the couple of months that the program will be up and running. So moving ahead to public involvement, as I mentioned, it is critically important that we include a wide variety of people around the state. And so not only do we have a 15-member stakeholder group, but we reached out to additional 47-plus individuals who've participated in one way or another, either through subcommittees or by monitoring the information on our websites. We created a specific page on the Department of Justice website so that the public can access not only the terminology of the bill, but all of the minutes of our work group, the schedule, so that they know what's going on and can attend. We also have created for the steering committee itself a page on what's called GovSpace, and this is a great place for us to be able to exchange information at virtually no cost. We're not printing a lot of paper. Everybody has access to it, whether you're clicking on at 11 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock in the morning, and it facilitates the discussion between members of the work group. So one of the things we had to start with is, what do we expect for the volume? And we started out simply with the data from the number of foreclosures that existed in the state by county. And so we took that number and then said, okay, that estimates about 1,430 people that are getting a notice of default on a monthly basis. Some of those notices of default are being filed by entities that do fewer than 250 foreclosures a year. So they're exempt. So we had to carve those out. However, there's a provision in the bill that says that if you're a homeowner and you are at risk of default, even though you're not yet in default, you're entitled to request mediation. So we had to add them back in. So it's our best estimate that we will have approximately 1,516 people in Oregon asking for mediation every month. So to figure out what it's going to cost and how it's going to work, the first economic payment is the payment of $100 upon filing of the notice of default. Of that $100, $5 goes to the county clerks for their handling and basic management of the finances of receiving the checks. We at the Department of Justice will use approximately $7 of this for management and oversight. The rest of that money will be going to the mediation services provider. So once we get the program up and running, the goal is that there will be no further cost to the state for the operation of this program in perpetuity, because it is basically a fee per notice of default basis. So it's scalable. If the numbers of defaults go up, it's no more money out of the state's pocket. If the program has a reduction in notices of default, there's no additional cost to the state. If a homeowner wants to go to mediation, they will pay up to $200. Now, some of that we've agreed needs to be waivable for someone who doesn't have the extra $200, but we felt it was important that every homeowner going to a mediation have skin in the game. So we wanted to make sure that they had something to pay. The beneficiary will be paying $425, and those fees will be going directly to the mediators, private sector people across the state. And we approximate that on an annual basis, that's about 27 full-time mediators around the state that will be working on this program. We did some employment calculations trying to estimate the number of folks, as I indicated here, who are in the private sector participating in this program. There's very little state employee time that will be in the program itself. The mediation services provider will be private. The mediators will be private. The only state funding will be our limited role in monitoring and oversight.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Devanovich, you said at the end this will fund 27 mediators. Are they going to be monthly, hourly, or fee for service?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, these are purely fee for service.
Thank you. Thank you.
So if they do 10 mediations in a year, they get paid more. None of these are on any kind of fixed fee basis.
Thank you.
In addition, the mediation services provider, we estimate, is going to have to hire support staff and personnel to monitor and manage the program themselves. So you could add 10 to 20 of their people plus the 27 FTE mediators. So there's a lot of private sector jobs in this program. So we turn to implementation.
As I mentioned, we are in the process of hiring a contractor. We started out with three.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Before I forget, I'll go back to the maybe the last slide. The 300 at risk into the 1500 number. They have not been sent a notice of default, so there's no notice of default fee. Where does the fee come in for their mediation?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron, good question. The way we've modeled it is to recognize that if somebody wants to take advantage of mediation, they should pay whether they're at risk or actually in default. And likewise, if the beneficiary is going to participate in mediation, they need to pay a similar fee. So essentially, we've adopted a program, regardless of whether you're in default or at risk, you will pay the same as everyone else.
Thank you.
As I was saying, we need to hire a contractor to run this statewide program. We started out with six proposals in response to an RFQ. We developed a short list. We sent that out to three entities, and the winning bidder was the Collins Center for Public Policy, which is based out of Florida. We're now in negotiations with them to enter into a contract, and this describes that process.
Don't they have to hire lawyers from Oregon? They're not going to bring them from Florida, are they? Mediators.
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, our initial request for information went to every mediator in the state and everyone that we could possibly find that might be interested in it. We then got requests for qualifications back and established a short list, and these folks clearly elevated to the top of the list. We were very much desirous of having as much work done here in Oregon, and the Collins Center has committed to utilizing mediators that are already here in Oregon, including existing community mediation centers.
I have two resumes I'll send you from constituents.
Right. There are a lot of good community-based mediation programs that are already in existence. There's no reason to recreate a program, so it's going to basically piggyback on existing programs.
Thank you.
And we'll actually have a slide on the local resources in a second here. Training, just to point out, we've already established a schedule to train mediators.
St. Cameron, you may have a question before you
go back. The Stakeholder Evaluation Committee, who was that?
The stakeholder, Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Representative Cameron.
Thank you.
The Stakeholder Advisory Committee was a subcommittee of the larger stakeholder group that Keith described earlier, and so that included representatives of housing counselors, representatives of community mediation programs, a representative from the Housing and Community Services, a representative of the banking industry, and
title.
And I don't know if we had a title company. I think we had the banking industry, but not a title company.
Clarification.
Go ahead.
So that was the members of the evaluation committee that chose the provider.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. We're offering training. We've put that information out to get this program up to speed quickly. Through rules, the Department of Justice has described the minimum qualifications for mediators in addition to the basic 32 hours that mediators need to receive. There's an additional 24 hours of training that's required of anyone mediating in the program. And this schedule just describes that geographically around the state we'll be offering that. This training is being offered to mediators who meet the minimum qualifications free of cost. And so this is something that we're doing to get this ramped up and get the requisite number of mediators available when the program starts.
You asked about, Representative Wisnett, the programs are in place. We've obviously already done a lot of outreach to these entities, and these folks here in the communities across the state have already been in discussions with the Collins Group about coordinating and working. So as you can see, we're trying to reach out to all four corners of the state as best we can.
Thank you.
And then further, Representative Wisnett, to your question earlier about evaluation, we did at the very beginning recognize that we want to make sure that we're evaluating this program from the very beginning. So we've put together an evaluation subcommittee, and that subcommittee has also identified the specific kind of data points that we want to be monitoring from day one. And that's part of the contract with the mediation services provider. We at the Department of Justice will obviously be doing some oversight, but an advisory committee will have primary responsibility for doing the evaluation in perpetuity. That ends our presentation, and we thank the committee for its time and attention.
Representative Smith, question?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair.
So thanks a lot for this, and I want my attention turns a bit to the Housing Alliance proposal, and if you'd rather not talk as much about that as we talk about the proposed rules, I'm fine with that. But I wanted at least your insight that when I saw an earlier draft of the proposal, a more significant share than I think under the current proposal was to direct assistance, and now more is to counseling. I wanted to ask about that generally. I mean, my hope is as much as possible we can, you know, make this thing a gift that keeps on giving. At the same time, I understand how important the counseling is. Can you shed some light on those choices?
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnett, Co-Vice Chair Smith. The bill did not provide a funding mechanism for anything other than the mediation program. So the economic model that we're working with is how to get the program up and running at as low a price tag to the state as is possible. Recognizing that there were going to be funds necessary to provide housing counselors who are necessary under the bill, we work with OHCS to figure out how much would it cost to make sure that a homeowner gets a chance to meet with a housing counselor as quickly as possible. Ms. Van Vliet will be up in a minute to address that question in more detail. With respect to direct legal assistance, you know, how much money should go to that is obviously up to the emergency board. What we've recognized is that there are a lot of homeowners that have problems that a housing counselor cannot adequately address, and therefore the joint proposal that OHCS and the Department of Justice made to the e-board included a provision for direct legal assistance for homeowners. We at the Department of Justice can't represent a homeowner. They may need legal assistance. The proper amount of funding for that program is perfectly up to the discretion of the e-board, and it's way beyond my expertise.
Sure. Paul, sure. So and it may be to other folks who are going to testify on this matter, and when I'm saying direct assistance, let me be more clear, I mean not direct legal assistance, but actually figuring out ways to get money into the hands of homeowners. And not necessarily in terms of grants, but my own preference would be if we could use this as sort of seed corn to help some version of a revolving fund, so that if we, you know, help some people and then they're able to pay us back, we're able to help some more people down the road, because I don't see us getting out of this mess, at least in the next several months. If either of you have feedback on how we could get something like that started, that would be great. Specifically, what legal authority would need to be provided, if any, that is already legally provided? Is there any action by the legislature that would need to be taken in order to do some maybe relatively pedestrian, maybe innovative stuff with helping people either with foreclosure avoidance or with staying in their
With hopefully foreclosure avoidance, or maybe with other land acquisition models. If you have any thoughts on it, it would be really helpful to understand the breakdown, and otherwise I spend the words here so that somebody else can say something when they come up.
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnick, Co-Chair, Co-Vice Chair Smith. That's beyond our purview in the Department of Justice, other than to say that the multi-state settlement that we entered into contains a variety of funds that are available to homeowners to do a lot of different things, including principal write-down, including refinancing, including a graceful exit out of their home and transition to rental property, includes funds available to help avoid blight. One of the things we're at the Department of Justice will be doing is making sure that those funds are properly spent. OHCS will be doing the outreach regarding all of those settlement aspects, and it's critically important that we reach every Oregon homeowner that is eligible to take advantage of these programs. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that are helpful to Oregon homeowners, and from my perspective, we ought to get every dollar that Oregon is entitled to.
Thanks.
Representative Shan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A great amount of work in 3 months. Boy, you guys have really defined this thing. And I think my comments sort of echo Representative Smith's on the counseling. That was one of the really big elements of the final negotiations of this bill. And I think one of the most important things is having those counselors that are intimately familiar with the national mortgage foreclosure settlements and being able to implement those programs and have those relationships with those banks. So am I hearing from you that we have your assurance that that's the case? It's not just to push them into mediation, but to solve their problem.
Co-Chair Holby, Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Vice Chair Sheehan. The housing component is critically important, and I'm sure Ms. Van Vliet will echo what I'm saying. It's unclear, every case is different, and it's hard to generalize what the right outcome is for an individual homeowner. The model that we've put in place essentially involves getting homeowners together as a group and doing the initial education of them, because every homeowner has the same basic question. What's a loan modification? What is a notice of default? What can I do to save my home? But then individual attention is critically important, and the more time that they spend with a housing counselor that understands all of these various loan modification programs and helps them get their financial papers together, the housing counselor may very well be in a position to help them understand that they really don't have many options. You know, there are some people that just don't have any means to stay in their home. In that case, helping the homeowner negotiate a timely and graceful exit from their home may be the best thing for them. And some of the financial institutions have transition programs where they will help the homeowner move into an apartment. You can do a deed in lieu. There are a variety of different programs. So the housing counselor component is a very important piece of this legislation.
Thank you.
Other questions? Appreciate your testimony, and I think we'll go ahead and move on with the next part of it. Thank you for all the hard work that I know you've been putting into this and involving all the stakeholders to put together your proposals.
Thank you, co-chairs. If I can end on a personal note, this is likely to be my last time before this committee. It has been my sincere honor and pleasure to work with each of you. I know how committed you are to the people of this state, and it's been a pleasure to work with you.
Good afternoon. If you could introduce yourself for the record and follow up with your presentation.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm here to share information on the foreclosure counseling and outreach plans presented to the Emergency Board just this afternoon related to Senate Bill 1552. So I should be able to answer a few of your questions that were just you were just mentioning. And also the national foreclosure-related settlement with the five banks. I want to tell you the Housing and Community Services Department's sort of approach to that. Following that presentation, I would like to provide an update on the current programs and progress of the foreclosure prevention programs funded by the U.S. Department of Treasury's Hardest Hit Fund, and importantly, to give you some information related to the issues you might be concerned about due to recent media coverage of these programs. I am joined here today by Mike Aumann, who is the administrator of the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative, and Ben Prey, our agency's legislative liaison. You have in front of you thick packets of information, which I hope don't are helpful and do not to overwhelm. What I want to do is just kind of paint the picture of the foreclosure issues in our state and provide some context about what we see as the continued really crisis. While we are in a better state, in a better position today than at the height of the recession, foreclosures remain a critical issue throughout Oregon. By our numbers, more than 23,000 homes are currently in the foreclosure process, and that's a 3.86% rate. It's the highest rate of any first quarter foreclosure rate in our state in history. Additionally, data from the DOJ workgroup that you just heard about suggests that up to 18,000 Oregonians may be eligible for mediation and counseling per year once the Senate bill is fully implemented. I think it's important to also underscore that each foreclosure can cost local and state government up to $19,000, and that more than a million homes neighboring those foreclosures experience an average of more than $8,000 in property value decline. While negative equity is less of an issue here than in some other states, we do estimate that Oregonians are collectively more than $4 billion underwater on their mortgages. So what I want to do now is talk you through the pieces of the request we've made to the Emergency Board Subcommittee requesting funds from the settlement that Keith talked about for aspects that our agency would implement. So the first is the pre-mediation counseling. We've talked a little bit about this afternoon. Housing counselors do indeed play a critical role in helping homeowners as they seek alternatives to foreclosure. Towards that end, the Senate Bill 1552 intends for homeowners to have the ability to meet with a foreclosure counselor in their area in order to prepare for mediation with their servicer. There's a provision that allows for homeowners to opt out should a counselor not be available within that time frame. And while mediation services are paid for through the fee structure, as you've heard, counseling does not have a revenue generation aspect in the bill. And that's really the reason we're suggesting the use of the settlement funds for this purpose. So just earlier this afternoon, we requested, and the E-Board subcommittee is advancing our recommendation for $3.4 million to be used until the end of the biennium to fund this pre-mediation counseling. So this proposal has been well thought out, drafting on the work of the DOJ work groups. We will add much needed depth and support to a statewide counseling network that is currently existing but facing budget cuts and can be challenging for homeowners to access today, even before 1552 is implemented. So what we have proposed is that we add to that existing network 25 new counselors to be managed and monitored inside local agencies, so not on the state's payroll, but rather hired by local agencies who have expertise in this. My department has requested just one FTE to manage this program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Director, you said 25 additional. In my district, we have three counselors now. So this chart is showing we're going to get, it'll be 5.5. Is that correct for Central Oregon? Or more than that,
because co-chair Holvey and co-chair Wisnett. That's correct. That's how they would be allocated. The numbers on the map are above and beyond what's existing today. Correct.
Hey, and follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
The people there now, their fee for service. So, in Central Oregon, we have three. their fee for service. So they'll continue doing that with the other programs we have, and these are in addition.
Yes, Co-Chair Holvey and Representative Wisnett, I believe that's correct. I think what we want to be able to do is add capacity quickly, and I think what we need to be able to do is provide grants and contracts, funds to be able to hire and train, and then we'll transition in the next year if the program continues to fee for service. That's correct.
Thank you.
So the map, I think, is important to look at here for a minute. It illustrates our best projections today, where the counselors can be put to work, and reflects, again, the assumptions of the work group. And 25, in some regards, is a significant increase over the existing numbers. You can kind of see as that is spread across the Oregon's 36 counties, it can may well still be a big challenge for folks in every corner of the state to access a counselor within 30 days.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I'm going to answer my own question here, but the previous presentation, we saw 1,500 a month potential mediation homeowners, yet we're scheduling 200 counseling sessions per month. The difference being...
Right. So, Co-Chair Holvey and Representative Cameron, I think what we want to be able to do is have kind of a staged approach to providing counseling. We believe that some of those 1,500 a month may well get their questions answered and get the tools they need through a group workshop or through online learning tools. And for those who need more of the one-on-one, I think that's the 200 we'll put through the system. So it is definitely, I'm being told that 200 is an existing number of, that's the existing number that goes through the system. Is that correct? But I think the point about trying to winnow down those who actually need a one-on-one counseling session is important, and we'll have to see how this goes. This will be a bit of a stretch, but we think it's doable, and we know we're going to be able to come back to you in December with a check-in for how it's going. So I don't know that I answered your question adequately.
Well, thank you. Well, you just raised a question. If the 200 that was up there is existing, what's the forecast as the Department of Justice is forecasting 1,500
staff? Do we have
new?
Do we have that number?
So, 200 co-chairs and members of the committee. 200 represents the number that's currently going through the counseling system per month statewide, and that's about 23 FTEs now, and that looks like that'll be about 18 at the start of the next fiscal year. So the 25 group that we're proposing would be in addition to those 18 or 23, and trying to get that service from 200 per month to around 4 or 5 or 600 per month per the demand.
Thank you.
Okay. Should I continue?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the next area where we have requested funds and wish to put together a program relates to outreach. And there's several sort of key aspects to this I want to just highlight. The first thing is we want to ensure that homeowners take advantage of the assistance made available through the multi-bank settlement that Keith talked about. As you saw, through that settlement, more than $250 million of bank credit money is available to the customers of those banks, those homeowners, through refinancing and modification programs. It's also important, we think, to perform outreach to the more than 10,000 homeowners that are collectively owed more than $18 million, given that they've already been foreclosed on and their servicers will likely be somewhat ineffective in reaching them. So part of the outreach to get to the bank customers, if you will, who are entitled to the bank settlement, separate from what we're talking about. Second, we want to aim to increase participation in both the counseling and mediation programs made available to homeowners through the Senate Bill 1552, and to connect all the disparate programs currently available, provide a clear information and a reliable sort of gateway to the many services that can help Oregonians avoid foreclosure. So this graphic really just kind of illustrates how some of the, it's a little less nuanced, it's a little less complex than the last graphic you saw. But the idea is that there's a lot of information. It can be very overwhelming. We see and work with homeowners who are fatigued dealing with the complicated system at the federal, state, and their bank servicer level. As we introduce these new tools into the marketplace, it feels essential to us that we do it in a way that doesn't duplicate existing services, but rather increases access and understanding of the complex programs. So the third area that we're requesting funds from the e-board is for legal assistance. We have requested a total of $667,000 for the rest of the biennium to contract, again, not put them on the payroll in our department, to contract for legal services providers. A total of seven, we think, will do the trick to provide support to those homeowners with the more complex issues that a counselor probably isn't equipped to handle. I would underscore that these contracted lawyers would be able to attend the mediation sessions with the low-income homeowners and to provide training to members of the bar, to counselors, and mediators across the state. So I think that is another tool we put in place that bears fruit in other ways.
Do you have an estimate of the capacity needed for attorneys? I mean, do you have a guess of how are you going to decide who gets to have legal advice and through legal assistance and who doesn't?
Yeah, Co-Chair Holvey, I think we have some notions about that. I think we need to do more work and analysis of that. So this is a fairly simple set of assumptions to get to the seven and the costs attached to that. So I think we'll have to do some, if not rulemaking, stakeholder engagement, public process to get at that.
Do you currently have an estimate of approximately how many people, consumers a month, those seven attorneys will be able to?
We have that. Yeah. We don't have it right here today, but we'd be happy to follow up.
Thank you.
So what I'd like to do, if I may, is really transition to the update we requested on the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Program and the use of our federal hardest hit funds, if you're ready for me to do that, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And actually, this part of my testimony you do have in writing in front of you. I want to provide an overview of the current programs in progress. But first, want to address issues you are likely to be concerned about due to recent media coverage, those being related to a contract our agency has with a firm called Further Development, which is led by former Portland City Commissioner Eric Sten, and the issue of the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program payments made to participants who were later deemed ineligible. So as a bit of background, when I arrived as Oregon Housing and Community Services new director on October 1st, I was faced with many challenges in several different areas of the $1.5 billion agency I was brought in to improve. The department's primary business of funding multifamily housing was under fire for questionable decision-making, and its response to the $220 million foreclosure prevention award from U.S. Treasury was being criticized from all sides for not getting money out the door and in the hands of struggling homeowners who needed it. When I stepped in as director, the agency was devoting a significant amount of its resources to exactly that. Its efforts were not being devoted to quality assurance or to compliance, but rather getting money out the door. Just before I arrived, understanding how significant the issues they were facing were, my predecessors brought in current Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative head Mike Ahman from another agency to help get things straightened out. Among other things, Mike identified documentation compliance issues in the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program that had been created by the overly complex criteria the agency had set and by severe understaffing. That created attention by the U.S. Treasury and a requirement to clear those internal audit exceptions. That ultimately entailed terminating 242 of the participants that we and our community partners who pre-qualified them believed were eligible. That was a painful process, and many of you received phone calls from participants who had been terminated from the program. Our records show that the median income for the terminated participants was $25,000 a year, and that the vast majority were suffering from unemployment or underemployment. These were not families who were attempting to defraud the government, but those who were experiencing hardship and, in most cases, met 8 out of the 9 eligibility criteria. But because the current year's tax returns weren't out or they had difficult-to-document sources of income, their files lacked the documentation to clearly show how they met the 25% loss of income criteria my agency had set. Under those circumstances, and because of the significant resources it would take to attempt to retrieve the payments they had already received, the agency chose not to recover the assistance provided to those applicants before they were terminated from the program. In total, $1.7 million, or 0.75% of the hardest hit funds, went to make mortgage payments for these homeowners. I will note that in attempting to fix a compliance issue, the agency created a waterfall of issues, and quite honestly, it staggered the understaffed division. Meanwhile, the agency was also working on a small pilot project using an allocation of $10 million, or 4.5% of the hardest hit funds. These funds had been set aside early on in the program to try to develop a way to get mortgage investors to reduce the principal balances of troubled homeowners who lived in regions that were hardest hit by the economic downturn and suffering up to 40% loss of property values. In those circumstances, families who went from having 2 wage earners to 1, or who lost a business or saw a serious decline in revenues, could no longer make their payments. And because of the loss of property values, their mortgages were underwater and they could not sell their home to get out from under the debt. Banks weren't working with them on restructuring their loans, and they were facing foreclosure. The prior leadership of the agency had been approached by former Portland City Commissioner Eric Sten, who now runs a consulting firm, to develop a solution that would not rely on grants of hardest hit funds to make payments for homeowners or lower principal balances, but instead to buy troubled mortgages at a discount from investors like Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac and make new smaller loans to the homeowners that the current market value would support. For homeowners who could qualify for the new lower payment, this would keep them in their home, keep a vacant foreclosed home off the block, and for the investor, eliminate the lengthy and costly foreclosure process that would result in the same hit to their balance sheet as selling the loan at a discount. If it worked, this program would allow the agency to package and resell the new loans and recycle the hardest hit funds to new homeowners. Prior to selling the loans, the agency would be receiving monthly payments from homeowners and be able to recycle those proceeds. So the hardest hit funds would not only not be a subsidy program, it would produce revenue that could be reinvested with other troubled homeowners. The agency entered into an agreement with Mr. Sten's consulting firm, Further Development, in September of 2010, and they began the research and development process of negotiating with national investors and servicers. It was decided to pilot the effort in Jackson and Deschutes counties because these two regions were understood to have some of the highest percentage of underwater mortgages. The agency's top leadership managed this contract directly and did not share details of it with me until I had been at the agency for a few months. When I learned of how long the contract had been running and that it was a flat fee contract that had not produced results, I required an immediate full analysis of the program and a contract renegotiation. At that time, I had not fully understood that we did not have the skill set or experience on staff to do that. My new leadership team has extensive finance and business experience and has been deep into this contract and program details. Through that analysis, I came to understand that the delay in producing results was in large part due to the fact that after significant work and thousands of hours of complex negotiations, the basic model of buying loans at a discount had to change from buying the loan to buying the home and then reselling it to the homeowner with a new loan in a simultaneous transaction. That change required new actions on the part of investors that had to be negotiated. It also required Further Development to obtain a mortgage broker's license and for our agency to set up all the processes for loan origination. Further had done their part, but we had not done ours. It was at that point that I entered the agency. After bringing on new leadership and conducting our full analysis, I chose not to cancel the contract outright. Because of the substantial investment that had been made in research and development, rightly or wrongly, and how close the project was to proving itself out, I chose to renegotiate the contract, reassign agency staff, and set a clear line in the sand for performance. We have not paid for the development since March, awaiting a final renegotiated contract. They are due payment for work in April, but I wanted to secure their agreement on a new contract before settling with them. So what's the status now? Over the last 3 months, new staff assigned to manage this project has created processes to support mortgage originations by further development, and the opportunity to close loans just became available. 12 loans have been closed, and further development has a pipeline of loans they are telling us have been pre-approved by the investor and are in the negotiation process with servicers for short sales. As of today, I have a verbal agreement with the company that will be retroactive to May 1st of this year. The crux of our new contract will be the elimination of the flat fee, compensation only for closed loans, and the private firm assuming all the risk of non-performance. Oregon Housing and Community Services and its hardest hit funds will not be expended except at loan closing, after underwriting by our staff and sign off by the investor and servicer. I truly think this is the best course for the state. I cannot talk more about the contract structure today or offline, as is useful to any members. If those pipeline transactions are in fact viable and investors and servicers continue to move forward as they have indicated they would, by the end of the summer, the research and development funds invested with further development would reap an estimated $42,000 in monthly payments back to the program, including a 6% interest rate, which is program income. We also have an asset of $6 million that could be sold. If we cancel the contract now, the fees would have leveraged only the 12 closed loans, an estimated $12,000 a month in payments, and an asset of $1.5 million, not enough to justify the administrative expense and not enough to efficiently sell off in a pool to another investor. I will say much of the future viability of the program is wrapped up in a national debate. Last week, Senator Merkley met with United States Secretary of the Treasury Timothy Geithner to advocate for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's continued support and participation in principal reduction programs such as this one. I will, of course, be eager to get your thoughts and answer your questions, but we'll first take a minute to finish the update and give you the full view of the overall hardest hit program. And for that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce again Mike Ahman, who is the administrator of our OHSI program.
I'm Mike Ahman. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative. Continuing with today's presentation, the Mortgage Payment Assistance Program, we've had $126 million allocated to that program in two offerings. The first offering was our first round. We had over 4,500 participants in that program. We've since that time rolled out a new version of the program that is focused on unemployed homeowners. And we've, in partnership with the Employment Department, done outreach through the Employment Department to reach those homeowners. Our new application process is governed by our internal capacity. We are accepting applications as we can process them. That said, we are opening over 700 program opportunities each and every month. At this point, those opportunities have been targeted in counties throughout Oregon. On July 25th, we will be opening up all reserve slots on a statewide basis so that those slots can be filled and that assistance can get on the ground to homeowners. Finally, I would point out that the mortgage payment assistance has a reinstatement component to it. And that automatic reinstatement will bring participants in the program current for those that have an arrearage of $5,000 or less. That $5,000 in arrearage does two things. It certainly helps them avoid foreclosure. And secondly, it allows them to come current where they might be able to qualify for other programs, federal programs. Moving on, I will talk about the Loan Preservation Assistance Program. This is a program that will provide up to $20,000 in assistance for homeowners that have recovered from a hardship and have an outstanding arrearage. This would be offered in a one-time payment that would bring homeowners current and will be backed by a five-year forgivable loan, 0% interest. The pilot program is expected to launch in July with a phased rollout that will match our capacity to process applications. I'd like to provide all of this with the backdrop of some national context. The chart that you've got before you on the screen as well as in your packet has been provided by the U.S. Department of Treasury. And you'll see that Oregon ranks number one across the nation in terms of the total percent of our allocation that we have on the ground assisting people. Our percent is 22%. The next closest entity is Washington, D.C. I would also point out that even when you look at total dollars provided on the ground, Oregon ranks number three, only behind North Carolina and California. I would point out that California's share of this fund was nearly $2 billion. Continuing kind of the national discussion about this, I will reference the Special Inspector General's Troubled Asset Relief. He recently was provided a report, and this is details to systemic changes and challenges for the HHF program, including a lack of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's cooperation as the program was initially rolled out, challenges in working with servicers. I do want to comment on that for just a moment. At this point, Oregon is, again, a national leader. We have over 150 different servicers that are working with us to deliver these programs. And finally, a lack of program design at the U.S. by the U.S. Treasury. Each and every state was allowed to essentially design programs that that were not in any conformity. Finally, I would just take us to lessons learned, next steps. The demand for our services remains high. We know that. Each and every month when we open our slots, our mortgage payment assistance slots, they are utilized at an astonishing pace. And rural areas, they require a little bit of additional outreach, but we're seeing an uptick there as well. We know that more work remains. Again, under the leadership that Margaret has put together, we have improved our customer service. Our staffing levels have increased to handle the workload. We have more emphasis on our compliance. And again, just echoing the national conversation, we know that the program, timely delivery of the program, will still continue to be extremely challenging. Be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. As our time is just about up, we'll have just a few questions. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Okay, the mortgage payment assistance program is $126 million, and that's still on the table, or is it more than that?
That's correct. The, okay. There's a handout in your packet that looks like this. And that shows the what's currently allocated.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Real briefly.
The bank settlement agreement gives us another $35 million, I believe, is what Keith estimated out of the three. There was $3 billion set aside for refinancing for underwater borrowers. Is that in addition to this money?
Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Wisnett, that's correct. This is separate. So this money is from the U.S. Department of Treasury. It's actually TARP funds.
Yeah.
What Keith was talking about is money that the banks themselves are paying directly to states and to their borrowers. So they're separate, and that's part of the reason we want to make sure they're integrated. There's a lot of confusion out in the marketplace, and we want to create some better communication.
When he first briefed me, there was also a time limit on that, $35 million, I think. 3 years.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Smith, quickly.
Thanks. Margaret, thanks a lot for your testimony. I have no opinion on whether the work should be done by a consulting firm or done in-house. It does seem like a principal reduction strategy without subsidy, with the potential to revolve because the loans are profitable, seems like exactly the thing we should be doing. Like way better than direct subsidy, way better than just consulting, like exactly the thing we should be doing. What wasn't clear for me in listening to your testimony or in reading it was if your proposal is that you're shutting down that pilot or if you're changing it so that the compensation structure is different.
Chair Holvey and Representative Smith, we're not shutting down the program. We are changing the compensation structure in the contract, and we'll continue to have them do the work for us.
And for what it's worth, and we are out of time, but something like this is not going to happen a lot of times,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, what my fear was stimulus before. We've got a big bunch of money, and we spend it, and then it's gone. And what I wished then, and what I even said when I was sitting in a chair right over there then, was, boy, if we could turn this into some sort of revolving fund for a gift that keeps on giving for some other future legislator who's sitting in this chair to spend a little bit, we'll feel like way better stewards. And I'm feeling the same way now. And I know Representative Conger, who used to sit in that chair, felt the same way. And for what it's worth, I appeal to you.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, the $3 million that's dedicated through, or that you went to the emergency board for till December, is that enough, or are you going to be coming back in December and then asking to go more in the next biennium? Where are we at on that? I'm just kind of curious because we're dedicating X amount of bodies to that, those dollars to bodies.
Yeah, Co-Chair Holvey and Representative Matthews. I think what I understood that the subcommittee did today was authorize that the $3.4 million, and that it can be used through the rest of the year. Okay. It doesn't have to end in December.
Good to know.
So I know there's been a ton of conversation about that, and I believe it was resolved.
Lastly, Mr. Chair, quick statement, not even a question. I just learned of Mr. Dubanovich with his statement that this last testimony. I just want to say personally, thanks for all the work you've done for my constituents. Thanks for all the work you've done here in this building. You are the best and the brightest, my friend, and I really appreciate all you've done for Oregon. Thank you, sir.
So I do have one final question, and that is, you know, on one of your screens earlier, one of the problems that was identified as being one of the biggest was cooperation from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And, you know, a lot of these programs are predicated on having that kind of cooperation from the beneficiary. So since that was identified as one of the largest problems, do we see going forward that environment getting better?
Yes, Chair Holvey, I haven't been at this very long, but it's my understanding that at the federal level, Treasury is increasing its pressure on the oversight entity, if you will, for the GSEs, for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're independent of each other. One doesn't have oversight over the other. But I think the politics around Fannie and Freddie and Treasury are such that everybody's pushing. We can do what we can do in Oregon. It's a conversation that's much bigger than those of us sitting here today, I'm afraid.
Thank you. Appreciate all the work you're putting into this, and I know it's an ongoing effort and will probably be changed a few more times as the needs arise. Appreciate all your hard work.
One last question. Thank you for your hard work.
Representative Cameron, one last question.
I'm going to your website, and it says the loan modifications. I already tried to get the mortgage payment assistance while we were here and saw the qualifications, but the loan modification assistance sends you to your website, but I can't find it on the website. So maybe offline.
Thank you.
We'll take a look at that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You betcha. With that, I will adjourn the Interim Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection in the House of Representatives.